Coming to you from the City of the Weird. Exploring topics from the esoteric and unexplored to dimensions unknown. Shining a light of truth on the darkest corners of our reality. Welcome to the Curious Realm. Well, hello everybody. How you doing? Welcome to episode 80 of the Curious Realm podcast. Chris Jordan, your host here, coming at you live tonight from Austin, Texas. So nice to be back here in the studio. I love producing pre-recorded content. We'll be having Josh Turner from Paranormal Roundtable on in our pre-recorded segment after commercial break tonight. We always have the live guest followed by pre-recorded. We had quite a bit of pre-recorded stuff over the last month while I was out on the road, but I am back for the next little bit and so happy to be back here live with you on our regular Tuesday night, everybody. The news as of late has been grandiose, has been huge, to say the least, when it comes to the topic of disclosure. Typically right now, much like last week, is where we would be doing our news of the week from the social media group. But our topic tonight and our guest, I think is a little bit bigger than the typical social media news that we have. Our guest tonight in the first segment is the amazing executive director of the Paradigm Research Group. We are welcoming Stephen Bassett to the program tonight to talk about disclosure, the cause of disclosure. He and the Paradigm Research Group have been forefront of this for, well, better than 20 years now. And with all of the news coming out here in the last week, I mean, of course, the conversations that have been started with Lou Elizondo and To the Stars Academy and what led to UFO UAP panels in Congress has opened a huge conversation. But here in the last week, we have heard not only of crash retrieval programs, but we also just had Dr. Stephen Greer's big press conference yesterday with quite a few whistleblowers, things like that. And I couldn't think of a better time to welcome you on the show. Welcome, Mr. Bassett. How are you doing this evening?
It's my pleasure. And I've been busy. I've been riding a wave since 1996. It's been a long surf ride. But I'm not afraid. I mean, it looks as if the wave is about to hit the beach.
Yeah, it is. Remarkable in a lot of ways. I know I'm coming on 50 and I have been closely following the topic of UFOs, UAP research for easily the last 25 years of my life. And to see where it is now, is phenomenal. It is really amazing. I never thought that I would see the day that, we would have open discussion on the floors of Congress.
Well, you haven't seen anything yet.
I can only imagine, my friend. For those who are not aware of Paradigm Research Group, give our listeners a little background about who you are, how you came into this field of study, and how you came to found PRG.
The short answer is I made a decision to serve. I wasn't doing very well getting rich or all the other stuff you normally do. And I said, look, I think I want to serve. And so I decided, how will I do it? And my interest in the subject, coupled with a couple of key books that I read back in 95, particularly John Mack's book, Abduction, I made the decision that was it. I volunteered to work for John Mack's operation. I went out there, volunteered for 4 months. And while I was up there, I figured out my path. And my path was, because I always was a political activist of one type or another, not formal, not what we'll call full time, but that was my mentality. I realized that the problem was not science. It wasn't the evidence. It was plenty of evidence. It had been proven early on. Common sense would have shown you that it was obviously non-human intelligence. It was political. It was a political decision to embargo it, a term that I developed or came forward with in the early aughts to replace cover-up. It's not a cover-up. It's an embargo. It's legal. And so I said, okay, how do I do that? Well, I had this clever idea. Go to Washington, go back to D.C., where I have family and could live easily, and set up an office and file as a lobbyist for the issue. Extraterrestrial presence, sequestered technology, yada, yada. Almost certain that I would be the first one. Well, I was. And that caught the attention of the Washington Post. They check all the registrations. They sent a reporter out to interview me, gave me a really big article, big photo, and they put it on the second best page of the Washington Post, the front page of the what was then in the print world, the business section.
Wow.
So, and there's no way I could have gotten a photo that big on the front page, so I was happy to get that. That launched me. It gave me a cred. It announced that I was there, and I became, quote, the UFO lobbyist. For the last 26 years, I have been advocating for the political resolution of this problem, this issue, as a political activist, as a disclosure activist, a disclosure advocate, also underneath all that, an anti-war activist. For 26 years, doing everything I could to help within the limited resources that I had. Being a lobbyist was just one small part of that. Most of my work has been with media. Mm. I have done 1,500 interviews probably with all level of media, including the networks. I have logged 13,000 articles on my archive, on my website, paradigmresearchgroup.org, of professional, relatively mainstream media coverage of this issue. And that's only a fraction of the total articles that have been written. So I'm familiar with what the press and the journalists have written. Mm. And I know many of them. I've held 6 conferences, a mock congressional hearing, blah, blah, blah. So my work for 26 years has been to achieve a basic fundamental goal, which I conveniently defined for myself to make sure there was no misunderstanding, right?
Absolutely.
And that goal was the word you used. And I think you used it in the context that I created it back in the early aughts. Disclosure with a capital D, not a small d. Disclosure, small d, is happening all the time, every day, and will continue.
Yeah.
Capital D is like Independence Day, right? It's capital I. It's a proper noun. Disclosure with a capital D is a proper noun.
Yeah.
It describes an event. And that event is and can only be, by my definition, the confirmation of this non-human intelligence, extraterrestrial presence, by the heads of state of nations, starting almost certainly with one going first. At this point, it looks like it will be our president. And so disclosure, I believe, is very close. And that is the goal of the activist movement that I have been involved in. And then after that, we're in the post-disclosure world, in which case things will really get busy. I'll have to work 10 times harder as a post-disclosure activist.
Well, and it's been interesting to kind of see all of this from the sidelines. I mean, not just as somebody who has followed UFO, now UAP news, for the better part of his life, but as somebody who, I guess, just kind of loves following data trails, you know, and to see this almost slow balloon leak of information over the last many years, since Lou Elizondo first hit the CNN airwaves just before Christmas, with that real Christmas present of, hey, look, there has been a program. And that really conflagrated a lot of things. It got a lot of ears perked up in Congress who were in charge of money for such programs, wondering why they hadn't heard about such program. All kinds of things in your vast years of working in this. How have you seen the media angle on these stories and on the topic of disclosure change?
Well, I've watched it change, followed it for the full 26 years, and my archive goes back to 1947, though most of the articles are linked via the internet since 2006. Most everybody in the country is in the same position as you. They're watching it from the sidelines. Very few people have a relatively comprehensive knowledge of the history of this issue, going back to 47 when it really gets underway. They also don't have much understanding about the intricacies of how Washington works. They get lots of news about Washington. They get a lot of news about candidates. But in terms of how it works, they don't really know. And so as this thing moves forward, they're watching it with some, a certain degree of confusion, some excitement, a lot of uncertainty about what, where's this going and so forth. I get that. That's my job is to clear it up for them. Right. My audience is the vast majority of the American people who don't know the history, don't know where it's going, don't understand the time frame, don't understand what's at stake. Not the people that are wedded to this issue and on it every day on the internet and social media, who I interact with all the time. Don't get me wrong. I love these people. They're colleagues. They're the people that have carried the water. But what's coming is coming for everybody, not just for the people that care. All 335 million of us, actually all 8 billion of us. So it's a big deal. And so the message, there's two messages that I want to give your audience today.
Please.
The way to think about this is not a balloon, but a dam. Big old dam, little outdated, not in good repair. It started a leaking in 1947. They stopped that leak, plugged it up. And it held for a while, and it started leaking again. And it's been slowly leaking. The water's been slowly undermining the fundamental foundation of that dam from 1947 to 2017, at which point a significant breach opened up in it, and it started leaking faster. What's about to happen is the dam is about to collapse. And all the water, well, be this way. Most of the water is going to come out, right? There'll be some efforts to try to hold back some of it because they don't want everybody downstream to drown, but it's about to completely collapse. It took 76 years for that to happen. And the collapse that I'm referring to is, of course, disclosure, capital D. We're going to hear from the president on this soon because the necessary preliminary arrangements, I guess you could say, the protocols needed to do it the correct way, are moving along at an ever faster pace. In fact, even too fast.
Yeah.
So what am I saying? I'm saying that a stage has been set to allow the president in a safe and nonpartisan and relatively sober way to confirm to the American people that there is non-human intelligence engaging us. And if you want to speculate where they're from, go ahead. I think they're from other planets, and I'm going to win that bet. That will be the most profound event in human history. That's disclosure, capital D, the moment those words come out of the president's mouth. Now, everything else you're hearing about, hearings, Arrow, that NASA's doing this, whatever, all of this is setting up the staging. It's like when you're going to inaugurate a president in that period between the election and the inauguration, which is, I forget how many days, it's about almost 3 months. They have to put up all the scaffolding. They have to put up all the stage, huge stage there on the back end of the Capitol for people to come and sit and hold the whole thing. And then once they get the stage done, then everybody comes and the president goes up and gives the inaugural speech. That's what's going on. Now, why is that important to point out? Because a great number of people, most people in this country who have caught their attention, they think that everything that's been going on in the last 5 years, particularly in the last 5 years, is about the government learning that, wait a minute, there's something in our skies that we don't know what it is and we need to find out.
Yeah.
And so we're setting all this up to find out. No. It's like the analogy that I was giving. They're setting up all that staging for the inauguration. But while they're setting it up, they know who the president is. They already know. The president was already elected.
Yeah.
And then they set up all the staging, and then they have the inauguration speech. The U.S. government has known about the E.T. presence since 1947, latest, possibly a little sooner, maybe 45, maybe 43. Doesn't matter. The real start or the real situation that we have good information on is 1947, Roswell. And so they already know. So what is the purpose of all of the creation of the legislation and the Arrow and the multiple departments, the cross-agency committee, and all the rigmarole and the legislation that's going on? That is the staging. that will allow the president to come forward and not give an inaugural address, but rather a disclosure announcement.
Yeah.
And why are they doing it? Well, in the case of the inauguration, it is ceremonial. It's to instill gravitas to the election, the results, the president, the new president, and so forth. And it's for show. It's good public relations for the new government. It's good public relations for the country as we show the world how we safely and nonviolently transfer power. In this case, the one we're seeing, it's something else quite different.
Mm-hmm.
It's not fundamental. There are several benefits from going through all this rigmarole that's been going on for 5 years. It didn't have to go on for 5 years. It could have been much shorter.
Yep.
But it's been an interesting 5 years. The odd global pandemic killing 20 million people, the odd European war, the odd the increase in threatening to use nuclear weapons, the indictment of an ex-president, running up against the debt ceiling again and possibly destroying the economy. Things like that have not sped it up. It's slowed it down. It could have been done in 2 years, 2.5 tops, but it's going to take 5. This is a public relations-driven extrication project staged in order to improve how the people receive this information and how they view the government that delivers it to them. It is designed to minimize the blowback, minimize the anger, and maximize the sense in the people that better late than never, you finally did the right thing. You included the Congress, you included the Department of Defense, you included us, and all of that. And so we forgive you. That is what is going on. And also, by doing it the correct way, it's less disruptive, and it's minimally nonpartisan.
Absolutely.
In 1993, at the behest of and with the encouragement of Lawrence Rockefeller, President Bill Clinton did the opposite. He was told, go get the files, and he made an effort to go get the files and let it be known that they were looking at it and research was going on. The DOD was not happy about that. So this is the president trying to force it from the Department of Defense. And the DOD wanted nothing of that, and he basically told him to go pound sand. It didn't work, made him very unhappy, made his wife very unhappy, and so it was disruptive. This is not about that. This is about the entire issue being handed to the president via the mechanism of hearings. And not just any hearings. These will be the most watched hearings in history. The witnesses will be outstanding. They will testify under oath. It will set people's hair on fire. It will launch a journalistic media feeding frenzy, the likes of which we haven't seen since Monica Lewinsky. And it will be watched not only by hundreds of millions of people, but by everyone throughout government, throughout the military, throughout the agencies. And so, after a number of these witnesses have testified, I don't think it'll take very many, the president is then in a perfect position to say, as just a president, not as a Democrat, that like everyone else, I've watched these extraordinary testimonies. I have conferred with my top advisors. I've conferred with Department of Defense. I've conferred with the congressional leaders. And we have come to the consensus that this testimony does in fact confirm we are being engaged by non-human intelligence. We are being visited by extraterrestrials. We are not alone, whatever. And that is disclosure. That is what this is all about. And if people don't get that, they're going to be very confused. And so, one of the dilemmas that they face is that in order to pull this off, they actually have to keep lying, but for better purpose. There are a lot of things they can't say, because if they do, it will undermine the process. I liken it to trying to score a touchdown from the 1 yard line. You got to run the whole field, but you know, if you step out of bounds one time, the play ends and there's no touchdown. And so you're seeing them navigate the field, staying within the sidelines, not stepping out of bounds. And often to do that, they have to be mendacious or evasive. And a lot of people are confused by that and irritated by that. But I understand it, and I understand why, and I'm happy with it.
Well, and even in the first congressional hearing, followed by the second congressional hearing, I love the fact that there is now an annual UAP report. It's epic, and like you said, that is 100% optics. All this could have been done without that. It is 100% optics because that is the framework that most people need to accept. You know, that our government is looking into this. That is the quote official framework that their mentality needs.
But let me be clear. Those weren't hearings. Those were briefings.
Oh, yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Those were staffers being brought up to brief some members of Congress in public, which is good because they could have done all those briefings fully in secret. So there probably was some, quote, private briefings that go along with the public.
That was the point.
We haven't had a hearing since 68.
That was the point that I was going to bring up, was that any time that it got to a point where it came to, quote, national security, anything like that, it became, we'll discuss that in the closed door meeting after this.
Yeah, there's a classic example of what I mean by you have to stay on the field, you can't step out of bounds.
Yeah.
And it came at the first briefing, and that was the one before Andre Carson's subcommittee in the House. And Moultrie, who is now Undersecretary of Defense for Security, I believe, pretty high-level position, Bray and Moultrie came up, who were essentially running ahead of the initial entity, which was very loosely constructed. It wasn't a big deal. The UAP Task Force.
Yep.
And they came up to brief and let the public know that the Congress is paying attention and they're going to help let them know what's going on. It was all very good, but there was a moment toward the end where Mike Gallagher is a pretty sharp guy. Pretty sure he has a military background. He's an up and comer. Mike Gallagher is going to be a player, national player. He just suddenly, out of nowhere, and during the Q&A after presentation, he brings up to Moultrie, are you aware of the shutting down of nuclear weapons? And Moultrie's eyes sort of widened, and he was like a deer in the headlights there for a second. And that's out of bounds. Okay, it's quite simple, right? That is out of bounds. And so he simply said, no, we have no information on that. Now, a lot of people out there jumped out of their chair at that point, started screaming at the TV.
Yeah.
But that was a perfect example of, we can't step out of bounds. We can't go there now. This is the early stages.
Precisely.
Hearings are a good year to 2 years away. And there have been many examples like that. And there will be more. And all I'm saying to people is, folks, it's okay. Don't get too worked up about it.
Yeah.
They're getting the job done.
That's right.
Extraordinarily difficult thing. They're getting it done.
All of this is toes dipped in the water and litmus tests. Absolutely. And one of the things that we have discussed on the show regularly is, never expect them to disclose anything that they are not going to make a buck off of. The majority, even according to the director of Aero in the recent big NASA meeting that happened, the public panel, 2 to 5 percentile of cases are the true anomaly. And it's great to finally see. I've made the analogy on this show over the last year. Imagine paying a contractor for a wall and coming into 95% and them going, job's done. That's kind of what science has been doing with the 2 to 5% that is in variation, that is not provable. And like the NASA panel said last week, that is directly their job as scientists, is to investigate that 2 to 5% anomaly. I think it's very interesting that they are coming out as a panel when they are. I think it's very interesting that it came right up against not only Stephen Greer's big press conference yesterday, but up against the whistleblower who has attested to alien retrieval programs. Now, he has not said he has documents of them. He has not said he's seen them. He said that he had testimony from people that that were part of these programs.
That was coincidence. They didn't know he was coming.
Oh, I'm sure. NASA, absolutely.
NASA's entire briefing was simply for show. The top people in NASA, many administrators, have known about the ET presence from the day it was formed in 1958.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay. And so they know. In fact, they were under law required to not touch it. Find anything related to it, turn it over to the Department of Defense. That's literally in the Space Act. And so NASA could do absolutely nothing with it. And if that meant turning off camera feeds, if it meant having special codes, if it meant cutting feeds to astronauts, whatever, nobody in NASA, and that includes the astronauts in particular, could breach that law, because the ET issue is a national security matter, period. And so NASA has, whether it liked it or not, virtually been shut down on that. Now, that has not been easy for them. Believe me, these are a lot of scientists. They want to explore space, and they've always known from the get-go. And I say they, I'm talking about the key people in NASA, top people. I'm not talking about the entire people that are working for NASA, though many of them sure know there's an ET presence based on just, I don't know, cruising the internet. The point is that they've always known that if the ET presence could be confirmed, they could quadruple their budget. NASA would become the civilian connection to space, and space in a space in a universe, we're not alone. So it would be the best thing that ever happened to them, but they could not contribute to it. They've had to ride out this truth embargo since 1958, knowing that they're here and there's not a damn thing they can do about it. So why are they coming out now? Because after the major breakthrough in 2017, where the To the Stars Academy group came out and eventually delivered the major stories to the New York Times, which really turned on, well, really cracked the dam open significantly and increased that leak. Everybody involved, one way or another, has been, how would you say, and it's not some incredibly coordinated thing. I mean, this is a little messy, but they have been deciding what to do, when to do, how to be part of the staging of this. So NASA, what happened there, and Joe Biden is the one that picked this guy. And I'm certain that Joe Biden knows there's an ET presence and is probably known for 25, 30, 40 years. He picks specifically picks Bill Nelson to run NASA. Not just anybody, but Bill Nelson, who happens to be not only a former astronaut, but a former senator and a member of the Senate Intel Committee. The perfect person to be running NASA as it has to go through this final gauntlet. So that right away was setting the stage. Then they announced that they were looking at it. They announced that it was in their quote, in their purview, which they'd never done before. And then they set up a task force within NASA, separate from obviously the one at the Department of Defense. And then logically they needed to give a report. And so a lot of very smart people with PhDs and various foreign accents got out there and they started saying about this and that and data and recording data and doing this and doing that and all the kind of stuff that you would normally do if you just found out that there may be non-human intelligence in our skies. All for show. Now, I'm not saying that every person on the panel understands that.
Yeah.
It's possible that some of them actually think that, oh, NASA is finally going to start helping us to find out what this phenomena is. It's okay. It's all right. They are an essentially victims of the truth embargo. Everybody's a victim of the truth embargo.
Yeah.
Yes, because one, it lasted 76 years, which gave it plenty of time to make fools of us all. So I'm not criticizing them. I'm simply saying that they very, very, very soon are going to realize, ooh, We don't have to do any investigation to find out what it is. The government just told us what it is. And so that, again, so people are watching that and they're going and they're scratching their heads, particularly if they know something. Now, the upside of this is for those that are still feeling irritation about it. unlike the anomaly, not the anomaly, the analogy, that was a Freudian slip. Unlike the analogy of the inauguration where they set up all that stuff, stage the damn thing, and then the president gives the inaugural address, and they have to take it all down again, right? That won't be the case this time. All of these structures, whether it with task force, investigative groups,
it ain't coming down.
They're not coming down.
Yeah.
In fact, once the disclosure has happened, their need now completely manifests. And so all of it will simply shift from what are they to, okay, how are we going to deal and how are we going to address and deal and track and involve ourselves in this new reality in which ETs are, in fact, part of our world. So no money is going to be wasted here. Yeah. And NASA will be unleashed, all right? And NASA will become a major civilian source of information, a conduit, and it will thrive.
Yeah.
So no money wasted, folks. But until those hearings are held, the president is not going to announce his presence unless something unusual forces his hand.
Yeah. Yeah. And that is exactly what we've been kind of saying on this show, is that this is a fully planned dissemination of information that has come out. It really kind of seems that way, the way that things have come about, even with Lou Elizondo going on television with videos that were not cleared for media declassification, but were declassified. So, you know, the fact that he was able to even take them onto the media and still maintain a classification and pick up another government contract with To the Stars Academy, like...
Let's back up here. Let me help here.
Sure.
No insult intended. This is my job.
Please.
To follow this. Okay. Those video clips were approved and cleared by Congress, by the Department of Defense, to be taken anywhere, including the New York Times. They were cleared for that.
Okay.
Secondly, Lou quit, and I believe him. He quit.
Yes.
Probably for two reasons. One, he wanted to be involved in what was coming next, and he couldn't do it while working for the government. He was certainly frustrated with the fact that, barring something dramatic, they were going to drag this out. And so he quit, came out very, 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 very shortly before the To the Stars Academy announced. That was not a government contract. That was a perfect, fully private organization. And these people were citizens at that point, not under direct government employ, at least in terms of salary. I maybe not any kind of employ, which is why they could do what they did. And Lou was one of the 10.
Yeah.
And then what's happening since is not a carefully orchestrated release of information. There's been information coming out for 76 years, here, there, and everywhere. And I assure you, it hasn't been well coordinated.
No, no.
What has been coordinated is the response to the ever-growing flow of information, which they can't stop. In other words, they're not orchestrating, let's tell them this, let's tell them that. No. They're orchestrating setting up the stage for the president to confirm the extraterrestrial presence so they don't have to constantly deal with maintaining the secrecy and or the embargo on all this information while the growing massive interface of the world's people via social media and extremely advanced electronic communication is beating the hell up of the truth embargo. I mean, it's literally been shredded. It's a dead policy walking, and they've known it. And so essentially, this is about ending it, and the organization you're seeing is not about a dissemination of information. Wow. It is about a public relations effort to maximize the positive and emphasize the positive on this, because there will be plenty of negatives after the announcement. A lot of incredibly difficult questions that are going to be asked. And one of my jobs post disclosure is trying to, how would you say, help explain to the general public why this is important, why that is important, why this is being held back, and so forth, as we navigate the post-disclosure world. And that's going to be a lot of fun. This 26 years of trying to end this embargo has been incredibly stimulating, and I'm grateful for it. But it has been no picnic.
Oh, absolutely not. There have been numerous campaigns against this information, numerous campaigns against the people who advocate for disclosure through numerous, not only online and communities, but government communities as well. Advocates like you who have truly towed this hard, hard line for years, Stephen, we have people like you to thank for keeping these fires lit, keeping people aware, keeping press conferences going, events going, and keeping this in the eye that it needs to be kept in.
A lot of people carried that water, believe me, hundreds, and I unfortunately know a lot of them. One of the ironies of the truth embargo, going back to 47, is that as it evolved through the 20th century, is that, this is funny, the United States is a democratic constitutional republic with a whole lot of rights and privileges, no question. And the U.S. led the embargo, and our allies followed us, followed us, and went along with it, with very few exceptions. And that embargo was strictly maintained. Now, they used the measures they needed to use to control it and contain it and manage it. And by authoritarian standards, it was not bad. People talk about maybe this person may have been murdered, that person may have been murdered. It's possible. But by authoritarian rule standards, believe me, it was nothing. Here's the irony. In the authoritarian nations like China, the Soviet Union, and Russia, it was easier to be into this issue there than it is here. So for whatever reason, while the authoritarian states like Russia, Soviet Union, and China were not going to confirm the ET presence, they weren't overly troubled by the people in their country that were really interested in it. And I find this amazing, not amazing, but amusing, and still the case, right? I mean, there are a lot of things in China and Russia you better not say or get into, or you're going to have a problem.
Yeah.
But UFOs, UAPs, fine. I mean, so you know what can I say? I'll let historians sort that all out, but I find it funny.
It is a strange thing because they are countries who. And I guess part of that might just be because militarily they're countries that I guess tend to flex a whole lot more, you know, not that we don't, but most of our stuff we try to keep under hat, you know.
I think
that's a lot of where that, I mean, of course, a lot of the truth embargo started because of the Cold War and the idea of trying to get a better hand militarily over the enemy with technology, things like
certainly
that.
Certainly, the Cold War was the chief reason why they elected to go with the embargo. This is not an evil decision. It was legal. They didn't know where it was going to go. In order to understand the beginning of the embargo, you already have to go back to 1947, pretend you're living there, put yourself in the Oval Office.
Yeah.
And view the world from there. And from there at that time, it wasn't an unreasonable decision. And what they did, and probably it was just intended to be temporary, meaning let's embargo this for a while. Let's deny this, let's study. Let's see what the hell we got here while we try to figure out where the Soviet Union is going.
Yeah.
Are we going to build a lot of bombs? Are they going to build missiles? Are we headed for some kind of World War III, so forth. But if things worked out okay, then they might very well have disclosed in the 60s. Things did not work out okay. In fact, it became a nightmare. It turned into one of the most bizarre situations I think the world has ever been in. And the world has been in some pretty bizarre situations. Awful stuff, empires falling, hordes of people on horseback racing across the plains, slaughtering everybody in their path, whatever. What we ended up with was an acronym called MAD. I forget when it first was brought into use. I need to study that. I'm going to find out when it was first used. MAD is an acronym for Mutual Assured Destruction. The world has never been in a situation like that. In other words, the fundamental policy hanging over our ability to continue to live was based on the fact that we'd created weapons so awful that nobody wanted to use them. And since nobody wanted to use them, they wouldn't get used unless somebody insane got into power or there was an accident. Mutually assured destruction. We've been living under that Damocles sword for 76 solid years.
Yeah.
And it hasn't helped our mental health one bit. It has allowed for lots of proxy wars to take place that might not have otherwise. Because, okay, one of the nuclear powers is going to go in and start slaughtering a bunch of third world people. But what can you do? They have nukes. I mean, we can't get in there. Whatever. I mean, it's just been, as Stephen Greer came up with one of the great titles for a doc ever, and I almost did a doc 2 years ago, came close, but things have still worked out. I'm going to be dropping a fairly nice little media thing shortly.
Nice.
But his latest doc is called The Lost Century. Perfect title.
Yeah.
Just a perfect title. I haven't seen it yet. I've talked with Richard Dole about this and Bryce Abel and some others. I can write, but it's only with enormous difficulty. I have the attention span of a gnat. I was an ADDH kid when I was younger. And so sitting down and reading a book or writing, not my thing. But there is a book somebody's going to write, and it's going to be similar to the incredible book by A.B. Dick called the what's the name of it? And there was a series on it. I'll think of it. It was a rewrite of the 20th century in which the Nazis and the Japan win the war.
The Two Towers.
Man in the High Tower
was it with Philip K. Dick.
There's a book to be written, and it's essentially what would the 20th century have been like if Truman, learning that we had to crash vehicle, had basically told Ramey, look, let's quell this for now. I need to think about it. I mean, I've only basically he learns about it and has very little bit of time to make a decision. The press release goes out. Until then, I don't think Truman had a clue, and so he had to squash it the same day. He did.
Yeah.
Once that second press conference, just squashed it. If he'd take it, look, quell it for now, and then took about a week, 2 weeks to talk it over with his top people and decided, we've been through World War II. We won. American people are tough. This is trivial in some ways compared to what we just experienced. And this is something they need to know. And went ahead and confirmed the ET presence in, say, late July or early August of 1947. What would the 20th century have been like?
Yeah.
Well, let me tell you, I've got a lot of that rattling around in my head. I should hire a ghostwriter, but I don't have the money yet. But if I can raise the money, I might hire a ghostwriter. But this book needs to be written because that could be one hell of a book. I am telling you, that the ways it could have gone, the possibilities, it's just huge. And so that book needs to be written. But we'll never know for sure because he didn't make that decision, right? But now we're going to get the answer. I believe, and I want to get this out before I forget.
Please.
I believe disclosure is coming this summer. I believe it may be only weeks away, but maybe no more than months. The more than enough witnesses have been interviewed by Arrow, for sure, and we anticipate that they're already being interviewed by the committee that is most likely to hold the initial hearings. You're starting to see committees compete with each other to see who gets the first hearing. Representative Comer, who was the chairman of a very important committee,
House oversight, Republican. He has announced he's going to hold hearings. Hadn't said when. Fine. He has that right. Meanwhile, the committee that should hold these hearings, that and I'm sure wants to hold these hearings, first hearings, is the Senate Intel Committee. And so when Grush breaks ranks, and after quite a long time of trying to stay in between the lines, not step out of bounds.
Yep.
He files a complaint with the Department of Defense to the IG's office. He lets him know that he's been harassed because he spoke, I think, to some of the committees about what he was learning when he was working for the task force. Got a lot of grief, made the complaint. That complaint was accepted. The attorney that represented him was the former former director of the IG office for the Intel community, I believe. That's pretty significant.
Yeah.
And then he steps back and waits, and things get drawn out, not surprisingly. Arrow takes time to form, but it starts to form, but it's not racing ahead. Arrow's job is not to find out what ET's, whether the ET's here. He already knows. It's just to be there. And so it's not surprising that huge amounts of money is not being thrown at it, because that ultimately will seem a little awkward, but it's there. It is the marker. It's the scaffolding. It's in place. But from Grush's point of view, he's seeing it as more stalling. And finally, he had enough. He approached the media, eventually got hooked up with Leslie Kane and Ralph Blumenthal.
Yep.
And it's a major story. They took it to the Times. They took it to the Post. They took it possibly to a couple of networks. But they wanted it immediately. They wanted to immediately go for it, immediately put that story out, because Grush was not simply in a hurry, but he was. Hang on, just a second. Let me turn this off.
No worries.
That is. He wasn't just in a hurry because he was impatient. He had been getting threats, including death threats.
Yep.
And so. And he felt, I've got to do this. And so he came out as what I consider the first true whistleblower. All the witnesses that I'm aware of are not whistleblowers. Now, Greer has dealt with more, quote, witnesses than probably anybody.
Hmm.
He's been dealing with witnesses at one time for 20 years. I mean, he's got a huge list.
Yeah.
And I know that some of those people on that list are claimed to be and may legitimately be whistleblowers. To be a whistleblower, you have to, preferably be legitimately revealing criminal activity,
yeah.
Violations of law, if not significant violations of ethics, within your workspace.
Yep.
To third parties, not in your chain of command, because their chain of command wouldn't deal with it. That makes you a whistleblower. And he believes that, and more important, and he believes that the policy is illegal.
Yes.
And I know that Greer's got a number of witnesses that believe the policy is illegal. And so if they're coming out, they're whistleblowers. But most of the witnesses that have been emerging lately are just witnesses. They are not whistleblowers. And there's the public is not making this distinction. And it is not trivial. Again, if you're a whistleblower, you get the death threats. If you're just a witness, no,
yeah.
You don't get those. And so I know a lot of these witnesses don't want to be called whistleblowers. In the act that was passed in 2023 that provided protection to people coming forward within the ranks,
yep.
They did not use the word whistleblower. They used the word witness. And so when Grush makes the decision to make his move, so the Post, the Times, the others, the New York Times, they simply, this is a story too big for them to rush. And so they said, we can't do it. Not in that time frame. And they said, it's okay. And they took it to a pretty good choice. The debrief is solid. It's not major. It's not in the New York Times, but it does great journalism. It's focused.
It does.
And they've already done a lot of articles. So they took the brief, the exact article done. They went to News Nation because New Nation is new, wants a story like that, has already brought people on to talk about it. It's a legitimate news program backed by a major company. There's nothing wrong with it. And so they got the interview. And boom, all that drops on Monday morning, June the 5th, and my life suddenly becomes a little crazy, right? The point I'm getting at is that Grush's action coupled with statements from like Representative Comer that there's a nice, really important House committee that wants to hold those hearings.
Yeah.
It's forced Warner's hand. And it's also forced Biden's hand. They simply cannot now let this thing hang. Meaning it's not, you know, they managed to skirt the issue of the weapons being turned off, nuclear weapons being turned off. That's been testified to for 20 years, but can't get on the Hill.
Yeah.
Right. Can't get the proper traction because that one they can kind of get around. But a former member of the task force set up to address this issue, even though it was scaffolding, who said, I talked to a bunch of people in that context and they told me we've got crash vehicles and bodies. And he puts that out there.
Yeah.
And then we learned he's filed a complaint with the IG office that was actually held up. Biden can't hang out there. It's only a matter of time. His press secretary is going to start getting questions about that. What the hell is he going to say? And so they literally have got to pull the plug on hearings immediately. The president needs to do it so that he doesn't get drawn into this ahead of time, which is not what we want. And Warner's got to do it. He's not going to get the hearing. He's not going to be the first. He's not going to be his committee. He's not going to be the first committee. It's going to go to the House. And I'm nothing against the House. But look back at the major hearings and where they end up. This is as big as it gets. And the Intelligent Committee, the Select Committee on Intelligence of the Senate, is probably the most highly regarded, least partisan, prestigious committee on the Hill.
Yeah.
These hearings must start before that committee. And so I predict that they're going to make their move. And if I'm Biden, I'm calling up Warner, right, on the private phone and saying, Mark, little good buddy, please get these things going. Now, let me be clear. He can't force them to do that, separation of powers. But he can sure encourage them.
Sure.
I believe the hearing's going to be called soon. I think the number of hearings, 2 weeks of hearings of the testimony that I know is coming will be more than enough for the president to confirm the ET presence. Before things get out of hand. And that puts disclosure sometime this summer. So get ready.
Absolutely. I have been saying for the last little while, it is beyond the boiling point. We are at a roiling point right now.
Yes.
The meniscus is about to bust full on the pot. And of course, there were a couple of listeners who during the show, Stephen, have asked a couple of questions. One of them,
sure.
being about the supposed Project Bluebeam that is out there. And many, many years ago, there was when I first started heavily using LinkedIn to court guests. And it's right around the time that we first became connected. I had somebody within the communities who did a lot of work starting to get UFO footage and programs out onto regular television, things like that. And he told me that he was like, I've looked at your show. It's great. Listen to a couple episodes. I would love to come on, but I don't publicly speak about this anymore. He was like, I've had too many friends that have died under mysterious circumstances that I'm too worried about my family, and pretty much laid out the concept of Project Bluebeam as far as the government basically admitting to the presence of aliens in order to bring about a new technology and basically steal a section of the people and populace, kind of poke them toward action, which would lead to police state, all kinds of things, and a basic means of constitutional control, as is put out by so many hypotheses. Let's say, because you can hypothesize anything.
The question is,
where do you fall on that? Because, I mean, it seems as though you fully fall against that concept, which, you know, I've always said I'm not going to put it beyond the realm of possibility. I mean, there's definitely some nefarious things out there, and there's a couple alphabet agencies that anytime they've ever been brought before Congress I doubt they've told the truth because it's never been shown they have. But it's also their job, you know, like that's that we don't pay them to do nice things. And even the head of Aero during the NASA meeting was like, listen, I have access to the greatest panoply of instruments that are fully scientific. I just can't point them inside the United States. Like there are laws against that.
Let me help you there. Here's what I believe is the case. It wouldn't. By the way, Project Bluebeam is basically about a false flag,
yes,
partially generated by creating holographic images that seem to indicate an attack, or using alien reproduction vehicles, which people would assume were ET, and blowing something up. That's basically Project Bluebeam.
Yes,
it has become a kind of a bucket, a catch-all for every concern or every evil thing that people think government could do. So it's really kind of lost its what I would call focus. I believe that it's possible that as you go back enough years, probably before the internet, certainly, maybe even back in the late stages of the Cold War, don't know, that somebody at the Pentagon wrote up a quick brief about the merits of something like that. And that's, I think, as far as it went. I have absolute zero, next to zero concern that the government is going to pull a false flag on this. It's if they were going to do it, they needed to do it back in around 1990.
Yeah, it would have been done. Well,
1990, but not now. I mean, my God, it would be a disaster. It wouldn't work. Everything that's going on is not that. There's no indication that anything that is happening so far is prelude to a false flag. And so I'm asking people to try to be gracious here. Our government's done a lot of awful things.
Yes.
I'm an activist for that reason. And those are in the past. What matters is what they do now, next. We have an opportunity, I think, with this issue, particularly the truth, the power of powerful truth is going to be revealed, to reset and try to move into the truth business and out of the lying business as virtually a default position. An enormous amount of reform needs to be done both internally and externally in order to get out of the holes that we've dug. Actually, one hole, one giant hole that we've dug, and now we're so far down in there, we can barely see the sky. And that's why people are concerned and taking lots of recreational drugs and antacids and everything else. I think that disclosure is a change, or to put it metaphorically, a ladder big enough, long enough, that we could actually climb out of that hole, which is why I'm pursuing it with such passion. So I'm asking people to put aside all the anger they have over the Vietnam War.
Yeah.
The trillions of dollars that have been spent on endless programs that didn't work, simply because they were national security.
Yeah.
The Iraq War, the Afghanistan War, I could go on and on and on. The mistreatment of third world nations, blah, blah, blah. All kinds of awful stuff. Put it aside for now and try to be gracious as the government tries to get out of this hole. Praise them. Almost every member of Congress has got a Twitter account,
yeah,
which is so cool. I'm big on Twitter, by the way. I don't care what Elon does or doesn't do. Twitter is a powerful force, right?
It really is.
Yeah. So go on. Some of them have DMs. They actually have direct messaging. So you go on Twitter, send them a direct message, tell them how great it is that they've talked about this, that they're moving forward. Thank you so much. We appreciate it. If they don't have a DM, you can always just reach them in a way by putting at. So say it's Congressman Jones. So it'll be at Congressman Jones. Just put the at Congressman Jones and then put some nice praise for that congressman. Could be Comer, could be Bruchette, could be Gallagher, Carson, Rubio, Warner, Gillibrand, Gallego, any of them that are stepping into this issue, praise them. And try to chill as things goes forward. Praise is what they need. criticizing every little thing that isn't going the way you want is not going to speed it up. It's going to slow it down.
Yeah.
Right. Praise people for telling the truth, and they will tell you more truth. If all you do is criticize their lies, that just makes them angry, and they tell you more lies. So, you know, it seems a little simple that way, but in many cases, it's a little trivial. But when you're talking about truths of this magnitude,
yeah,
right, and there have been some interesting truths of late that, again, when people, that I've noted, that I think people are not responding to, that they need to praise them. And by the way, the one of the reasons that the irony that I mentioned is the case, where in authoritarian states, I'm not talking about North Korea, which is the ultimate authoritarian state, I pity those people, but Soviet Union, Russia, and China, that people can just talk about UFOs and no big deal.
Yeah.
Is because, as we are seeing, this issue is nonpartisan. It is very difficult to politicize this issue, right? Almost impossible. And so you're seeing some of the most partisan people in media and in the government that you can't bear to watch. In other words, you turn them on and immediately you break out in hives, have to leave the room. And then suddenly they turn up on the television and they're talking about this issue and they sound like a completely normal human
being.
Yeah,
they,
and you're going, oh. Yeah. You know what I mean?
It has been interesting. And once again, despite what anybody might think about Lou Elizondo, the whole process, MUFON, what have you, the beautiful thing, Stephen, is that we now have an open conversation.
Yes.
Like I've been saying, despite what you might think about one more alphabet agency called Arrow, what their charge is to come up with a unified reporting system. Aside from that, it's been stabbing in the dark. If you were a commercial pilot, maybe here's a form for you to fill out. You know, if you were a Navy pilot, like, oh, good God, we want to hear nothing about it. So to try and get even enough witness statements to scientifically comb through them was almost impossible because there was, aside from MUFON, next to no actual, here is a form that you fill out. So even the fact that there is now a unified reporting system helps the science move forward.
Well, yeah, but again, and I don't blame you.
Yeah.
Yeah, they don't need those reports.
No.
They don't need those reports to do science.
No.
They're working on crash retrieve vehicles and USAPs. The reason the reporting system is important is not because it allows them to do science. It's because this shows the people that they are taking it seriously and doing the right thing. And people are clapping and praising. Excellent. Now, what comes next? And we can wrap it up with this.
Please.
Is here, just to give you a sense of what's going to happen, right? Once the president announces the ET presence, which if they're smart, they'll do it late on Friday. It'll be late on Friday. So that everybody, including the media, has the weekend
to figure this out.
Yeah. And you know, and then the media to particularly the news people, right? The cable and network news people, to get out of your face in front of a camera and say some things and whatever. Give them a week. Give them 2 weekends. Then on Monday, the post-disclosure world really begins, and there will be a lot of journalists parked out in front of the public relations office or the press office at the Pentagon, the CIA, the Air Force, the White House, the Senate, the House, with a whole lot of questions. The big focus will undoubtedly be on the first White House press briefing, which had better come pretty quick. Okay. And I'm kind of sure what the questions are going to be like, because at that point, all bets are off. All restraints are off.
Yeah.
It's free for all. And so look for this question early. And it's the beginning. And this question is perfectly representative of why they need as much public relations prep as they can get, right? Excuse me. And I forget her name. She's a wonderful woman. Very good. I love her. The press secretary. Madam press secretary. Excuse me, but I mean no disrespect, but when did the U.S. government, at whatever level was appropriate, know that, in fact, we had an extraterrestrial or non-human intelligence engaging us? Answer, 1947. Follow-up question. Might be 45, 43, doesn't matter. Follow-up question. if I may, why are we only learning this now? Answer, national security.
Yeah.
Next question. Okay. Madam Secretary or Madam Press Secretary, is it true that we have had crashed ET vehicles that we've been researching on, and when did that start? Yes, 1948. Okay, next question. Have we successfully developed technology based on these ET vehicles? Yes. Okay, follow-up question. Has that technology been made available, particularly if it's profoundly significant, for the civilian population, the world, to be able to use to deal with the mounting pressures that we have? No. Why not? National security. All right, now let's take the heat up another notch. Somebody's going to do it, right? They may not the first time, only because even they are going, let's don't overdo this, right? We got a good thing going here, right? But somebody's going to do it, either at the White House briefing room or over at the Pentagon briefing room, whatever the hell. Excuse me. There have been apparently thousands, tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands report of people being engaged and even taken or abducted by these beings that made the craft that we are reengineering. Is that happening? Yes. Okay. Were you able to? Could you stop it? Why didn't you stop it? We couldn't. There's nothing we could do about it. Are you starting to get the picture of how much public relations is needed here?
Oh, yeah. It's a big meatball.
People don't start shooting their television screens with 57 magnums.
Yeah. It's and that's just it, is it like you said, a public relations nightmare, B, regardless of any project, you don't need a Project Bluebeam, my friend. All you got to do is come out and say that, and there will be a good 10% of the populace that will be shooting at their screens with shotguns.
Maybe not. Remember,
we hope not.
The scenario that I'm describing is after we've had hearings, public hearings in the Senate committee, Intel committee.
Sure.
That will be probably televised worldwide and watched by hundreds of millions of people. We've seen the witnesses testify. We've seen some very intelligent questions being asked of them. We're seeing this information coming out. Okay. How far it goes depends on what questions are asked. And so the public will be participating in this, and they'll be seeing it go forward, and they'll be very pleased about that. And then the president comes forward and confirms it and ends the truth embargo, opens the door for everything else. People are going to be very happy about that. All the millennials are not going to care about questions about us. They could care less. And so a good deal of the population is not concerned about those questions and the answers they're going to get. But a decent number will raise an eyebrow, and there will be those that will be irritated. All I'm saying is the purpose of public relations is to manage a situation.
Yes.
And we've seen it countless times with individuals, some celebrity, actor, actress, famous politician, whatever, does something really, really stupid. Sometimes it's so awful, there's no recovery.
Yeah.
But in many cases, they hire the top public relations person, the best, and they get together with them, and those public relations professionals come together with a way to restore this person's credibility, and frequently it works. That is human nature. It's life. It's how it works, and it works for people, and it works even for governments. And so this public relations project is well underway, and by and large, it's been moving along comfortably, and I still felt that it would get to hearings this summer. But I'm not unhappy about Grush coming out.
Me neither.
And getting ahead of the issue, because we need to get them done. We've got to get them done before the campaign start. And
yeah,
something could happen in Ukraine next week. All it takes is some idiot to toss a tactical nuke out there. And I assure you, hearings before the Senate Intel Committee ain't going to happen. And so we need it as soon as possible before something like that takes place. And Grush has just advanced the time scale. So I'm a fan of David. I'm his man.
Same. After watching and literally back to back today, before our conversation, watching not only his full testimony, but watching the entire, the entirety of Stephen Greer, I am invigorated. I am so happy to see, as you're saying, the time scale move forward, quite literally. It's incredible. It's great. I have fantastic hope. Like I said earlier, I'm not putting anything past people. You know, I don't think that, as I've said numerous times on the show, I don't think they'll declassify anything that they aren't willing to make a buck off of.
I'm gonna try to be more generous there.
Okay.
I really believe that. Look, I know enough about the government to know that the vast majority of people in this government, they make a good living, they don't get rich, and they don't do what they do to get rich. Mm. The contractors do pretty well.
Yes.
And there's abuses that take place. But the people that have been managing our national security are not doing it for the buck. It ain't getting a buck. And yeah. And the reengineering they're doing is primarily in the basis of national security. I'm not concerned about somebody getting rich off of it. I don't think that's going to happen, at least not yet, not internally. I'm worried about the weaponization
yes.
of this technology. And so we've got to get that out there so we can address that, because it may be we're not the only country that's got crash vehicles. And so, no, it's not about that. They will release information at the fastest pace they can to serve the public demand without getting too far ahead of their skis. And they're going to try to be orderly about it. And we will never get everything. Well, I won't say never. There will be much that will remain classified. However,
oh, absolutely.
You can tell people about something without revealing classified information. In other words, we know they have nuclear weapons.
Yes.
Okay.
We don't know the operational. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Do we know the deep classified aspects of that? No, we don't. And so if I were them, I would try to go this far. In other words, whatever the hell they got, at least be willing to say what it is
yes.
they're working on, but without revealing the details. In other words, keep details classified, but let us know. So if they're working on interstellar drive, I know they've got anti-gravitics. But if they're closing in on interstellar drive, which is a big damn thing,
yeah,
I'm not suggesting they come out and start revealing their research, but they certainly could admit we're working on interstellar drive. There's a lot they can do. I assure you, the post-disclosure, people are going to have trouble keeping up with all of the various revelations and information that's going to come out. There won't be a lack of it.
Yeah.
But there's no way they're just going to dump it all out there in an unorganized and disruptive way. They're going to be organized about it, but there's no turning back. And there's also something else. There's other nations which are working on this, and so if they don't bring something out that they probably should have, another nation will.
Yes,
and
exactly.
So we'll be reading it about in the Paris paper. I think our government, to the large extent possible, does not want to follow. They yeah. want to lead. So I'm very confident that the post-disclosure world is coming. It's going to be an extraordinary new era. It's going to be an extraordinary new realm. And I must say, I am quite curious about what that's going to be like. So with that, I want to close with this. Folks, my website is paradigmresearchgroup.org, or Google my name, Stephen Bassett with a PH. You can subscribe in the upper left corner of the front page. Subscribe to my email list, please. I am on Twitter. Please follow at Steve Bassett or search on Paradigm Research Group. I have a Facebook page for Paradigm Research Group and for myself. Feel free to join, follow, whatever. Social media is very important. I'm also on LinkedIn. You can find me there as well.
Let's network, folks. The more we are networked, the more tied together we are. If you're on Twitter, start hashtagging UFO Twitter. That's where the action is. All right. The more networked we are, the more influence and the more effective we are going to be when the biggest paradigm shift in all of time, at least of all of human time, arrives at our door.
Absolutely. Stephen, thank you so much for your time tonight. I cannot thank you enough. I want to have you on again and again and again. This has been such a candid, a fantastic conversation tonight.
My pleasure. My pleasure.
I will definitely be reaching back out to have you on again. And of course, with links to all of this, everything else. Thank you so much for your time. And we will definitely talk to you again soon.
Yes, indeed.
All right.
Enjoy your evening. Bye.
Take care. So, incredible conversation tonight with Steve Bassett from Paradigm Research Group, folks. You can, of course, find all of his content once again and all of his work at paradigmresearchgroup.org. That is his website. You can, of course, follow him on social media, Facebook. You can find Paradigm Research Group and all of their videos on YouTube. You can, of course, because we have all of our guests videos embedded, you can hop on over to curiousrealm.com/videos and get all of the Paradigm Research Group videos right there. Easy way to subscribe, like, all that good stuff. Of course, while you are online checking that out, make sure to stop on by curiousrealm.com/story. That is where you can share your story or experience of the paranormal, the extreme, cryptids, UFOs. If you're a targeted individual, you can share your story, your evidence, your videos, everything with us there. And we will share it with our experts on the show and possibly get you some answers to your case. Stay tuned through this commercial break, folks. Such a fantastic conversation. Right after this commercial break, we have another great conversation with Josh Wolf Turner from Paranormal Roundtable about Dogman, some of the history of Dogman here in Texas, as well as the upcoming Dogman and Cryptid festival going on here in Texas in September. So we will be having that conversation with Josh Wolf Turner right after this. With the rise in attention to the health benefits of cannabis and cannabinoids, including CBD, True Hemp Science has become one of the premier providers of full-spectrum CBD and CBD-related products. Using a proprietary spagyric process, True Hemp Science extracts maximum benefit from the whole hemp plant. Buds, leaves, stems, seeds, even roots. Every part of the plant is used and then reused to formulate a rich, complex profile of CBD, CBD derivatives, and terpenes guaranteed to provide the relief and benefits you need daily. Visit TrueHempScience.com to experience the best CBD oils, edibles, and topicals on the market today. And use code CURIOUS7 to save 7% off your entire purchase of $50 or more and get 2 25-milligram CBD cookies or brownies free. That website again is TrueHempScience.com and the code is CURIOUS7. Curious Realm Podcast is your source for the latest and greatest news and events in the world of the paranormal, esoteric, and forbidden knowledge. And there's no better way to spark the conversation than with items from the Curious Realm store. Choose from fan favorites like hoodies, mouse pads, coffee mugs, and more. Buy books and items from your favorite Curious Realm guests. Get your hands on the latest gear for paranormal investigations and experiments we discuss on the show. Open your web browser and stop on by the Curious Realm store at curiousrealm.com/store to buy the latest Curious Realm wear and out-of-this-world gifts for yourself, your family, or a mind that you want to open. That website again is curiousrealm.com/store. Have you considered starting a podcast? Looking for a way to make your business a voice of authority in an industry? Then Podcast Cadet is the solution for you. Whether starting a podcast for yourself, your brand, business, school, church, or just plain fun, Podcast Cadet is here to help you navigate the waters of the podcast industry. Specializing in one-on-one consultation and training with industry professionals in fields ranging from podcast technology and editing to distribution, monetization, and even social media strategies, Podcast Cadet tailors their services to the specific needs of you and your podcast. Do you already have a podcast and trying to find ways to engage and grow your audience? Sign up for your Podcast Cadet audit today. And let us help you explore new and exciting ways to leverage your content and elevate your podcast brand to whole new levels. From consultation and workshops to affordable podcast production and maintenance packages, Podcast Cadet is your one-stop shop for everything podcast-related on the internet. Visit PodcastCadet.com today to sign up for your consultation or training. And use code CURIOUS20 to save 20% off your entire purchase. That website, again, is podcastcadet.com. Well, hello, everybody, and welcome back. Thank you so much to all of our sponsors, especially to True Hemp Science. True Hemp Science is our sponsor here in Austin, Texas. They are your source for amazing CBD products. Stop on by and check them out, folks. TrueHempScience.com is the website. Their product is amazing. I have tried CBD from all over the country. It's the only CBD I've ever found with actual terpene profiles and amazing, amazing stuff. So stop on by, check them out. TrueHempScience.com is the website. Curious7 is the code that you want to use to save 7% off of your entire web purchase of $50 or more. While you are online checking that out, of course, make sure to stop on by CuriousRealm.com. We are now actually fully web 2.0 compliant, folks, fully podcasting 2.0 compliant. We now have transcripts officially for all of the episodes. I know we have quite a few out there that are hard of hearing, things like that. Quite a few people over the last few years who have asked for transcripts, and we have finally gone through and transcribed every single episode of Curious Realm and everyone from this point forward. So stop on by and check that out. And of course, stop on by the YouTube page of our guest, Paranormal Roundtable. Welcome to the show, Joshua Turner. Make sure to stop on by and subscribe to them, folks. They put out some amazing content, great, great stories from the paranormal and a fantastic community that they have built. Welcome to the show, Joshua Turner. How are you doing?
Oh, thank you. I'm not too flattered about that picture there. Looks like I got a blowback on my hair there. I don't know which foot that's from. That must be my wife. I think she likes that picture. That's where that
you'd be from. Surprised where I dig things up from, Josh.
Well, you're a tech guru, so you could be like, you know, getting into my phone. I actually don't have that one on my phone.
I immediately Google stalk people.
Yeah. So. Well, you got to, I guess. And you put Joshua. I never go by Joshua, but that's fine.
That's okay. Well, most folk in the paranormal community probably know you by the moniker Wolf. So
yeah, and Josh Turner.
Josh. So, but yeah, welcome to the show. I have been tuning in since we met. Actually, we had a chance to meet. I believe it was a Texas Bigfoot conference last year.
Oh yeah, Jefferson.
In Jefferson, and that was the first time we've met. We've seen each other a few times since. I've been tuning into Paranormal Roundtable since, and once again, love the community that you guys have gone through and built. Let's start at the beginning, Josh. What was it that first drew you to the world of the paranormal? What was it that, I guess, first lit the spark for you when it comes to paranormal and things odd and mysterious?
Okay, so going back when I was a child, I guess, was when I don't know how you say it. It's called Ojo Dotado in Spanish, okay. Which is like the gift of the eye. My tia used to say that, you know, like gifted eye, you know, and you can see these things. And so she said that my grandmother, my abuelita, my mom's Mexican, my dad's white. It was a cultural mix there, but I grew up knowing both cultures and the stories and legends that came out of both sides. And my mother's side, they would talk about this thing called the hombre lobo or the cadejo, which I learned later is two different things. And I believe I've encountered both. And the odd thing is, a lot of times people have encounters, they're by themselves. I was actually with people. The first time I had an encounter with this werewolf dogman thing, I've only had it one time. And it was, I was 15, and I've told this story like on a bunch of shows. I've been in the British magazine. I mean, if your audience wants to hear this, I mean, I've already talked about it so many times. I mean, I can tell it again.
Well, but recap it for those who may not have heard it and who may not be familiar with your story.
Okay. So when I was 15 years old, it was Halloween night and just kind of going over just the abbreviated version. Me and my friend Daniel were walking home, or he was walking me home because I had gone to his house. We gotten dropped off, and I was late. I broke my curfew, and my mother had called his mom and said, "You better tell him to get home." And she's a Mexican mom, and she was like, when I tried calling her, she was not having it. Like, she kind of went off on me in Spanish. And basically, she was like, "Pendejo, you better get home now. I'm not coming to get you, and I don't give a crap," and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, okay, all right, fine. And my mom was the manager of the local HEB, which is the grocery store there. And like, everybody would always tell me, "Your mom is so nice." I'm like, "She's nice to you. She's a good boss, but she's not." She was a pretty uncompromising mother, and she was pretty strict. So she was like, that night, I really screwed the pooch on that one, because she's like, "You had an 11 o'clock curfew and you couldn't even make that." And that's pretty good for a 15-year-old, like, because she knew I was going to stay out late anyway doing what we do, which is throwing eggs at cop cars.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's like a Taylor tradition. And I don't know if they still do it. I know that some of my younger cousins, just like 10 years ago, they were still doing that. So I don't know about now, but we were, you know, that's what we did every year, was basically throw eggs at cop cars. And so she's like, "I know what y'all were doing all night." And, you know, one of the police officers was friends with my family, and he had already called my mom and told her that he had seen me running off of Davis Street. So I was like, So I was already in trouble, man. She's like, "You're grounded anyway. Don't worry about it when you get home. I'm going to tell your dad too, blah, blah, blah." My dad would always, he was the corporal punishment disciplinarian, and they were separated or divorced, but my dad would never miss a chance to be, you know, the way he was. And so I knew I was in big trouble, and I was aggravated. So I was walking home, walked to the store with my friend. We got those big drinks from Circle K. And we're coming up the hill, and I was complaining. I was like, "Man, my mom's so mean, blah, blah, blah," which really and truly, 11 o'clock was a very liberal curfew, you know, and I should have just done a better job of getting home, but I didn't have a vehicle. So I was kind of at the mercy of who was going to drop me off. And I was like, "It's not my fault." You know, my friend's like, "Well, I'll walk you to Henderson's." And now Henderson, we called him Henderson because his name was Daniel too. But it was kind of like a couple blocks up the road, and him and his brother used to work on bikes, and they always had bikes like out there on his little house. When I say his little house, he had a little house that was outside of the main house. And so I was like, yeah, I'll just pick up a bike from him and I'll take it back to him tomorrow, you know? And so my friend Daniel was like, okay, I'll walk you, you know? So we're like just sitting there walking and talking, and I was complaining. And then all of a sudden we both kind of look up, and I see this thing sitting in a ditch. We both thought it was a dog. Then we thought it was a wolf. We were debating it. And if I remember correctly, Daniel, I think, went to go pick up a rock, you know, because you kind of pick up a rock and throw it at a dog. They'll leave you alone, you know. And we're like not mean to dogs, but a small town in Texas back in 1990, dude, people let their dogs run around loose. Yeah. So you had to be real careful. And the rules weren't like they are now, you know. So a rock usually would make them leave you alone if you just threw it in their direction. But this thing, we caught its attention and it turned and looked at us. And I was like, oh, whoa, wait a minute. That's not a dog. That's not even a wolf. I don't know what that is. The thing stood up on two legs. I mean, I could see like hands and everything. I've always been farsighted, so I could see very clearly at a distance what this was. And when it stood up, it was like immediately it ran across the road on two legs. I immediately knew that this was like not a normal thing even before it did that. And we were just like, whoa. And then I felt this burning on my neck and I realized that my shirt was ripped, and I looked down and the soda was on the ground. And I was sitting there, you know, just kind of stunned. And I looked, and my friend was already like halfway to his house.
Wow.
And he's always apologized about that. Even in front of my wife years later, we were at my nephew Paulito's graduation, and he was telling my wife the story. And he was like, I feel bad about leaving. And my wife was like, no, if he's not moving.
Yeah, know? Man.
It's like time stood still, and I didn't register why my shirt was ripped or why my neck was burning. It was because he had yanked on my shirt, which I don't even remember to this day him doing that. But he had to, because there was proof. He said, dude, I ripped your shirt trying to get you to move. So I gave this thing time, and it ended up walking between the neighbor's house on the corner, which is no longer there, and then his house. It was coming between the two houses. And now there was a big 8-foot fence there at one time, because I guess the city, the people that lived there. Now, you got to remember, this is the barrio. Hmm. And in the barrio, it was like there were a lot of people who did a lot of things that weren't correct. And so these people, they were drug dealers. And but they had moved out, and that fence was still there, and it was kind of dilapidated. And one of the things that I remember is they had a bunch of pit bulls there. And there was like something the city was trying to force them to deal with them or something, not leave them chained up. So they put in a big fence, like a big, you know, and it was still there. And so this 8-foot fence was like, it was an eyesore too in the neighborhood. I mean, you know, the neighborhood wasn't trashy. It was just old and kind of, you know, and there were some bad people. But for the most part, I grew up with these people. I knew these people, you know, and so, you know, I went to school with them, and there was a bunch of people my age in that neighborhood. So I felt comfortable in that neighborhood, you know, even though it was not the best. But I was walking back to his house, and my legs felt like jello. And then I got up to the fence, and there this thing was. It just kind of walked up to the fence, and I was just kind of wobbly walking. And then as I got up to it, my friend's dad came out and yelled, "That's Sal," and I ran up to him. You know, like I ran at that point.
Wow.
And I got to look at this thing, man, and it looked like a quintessential werewolf. Up to that point, I had heard of stories of the hombre lobo, and or the werewolf, or the haint. The African American people in our town called it the haint. The Caucasian people called it a werewolf, and the Latino Hispanic community, they called it the hombre lobo. I didn't know what it was. I didn't believe in it. I didn't believe in La Chusa, La Llorona, El Chupacabra. I didn't believe in any of it. It was all mentiras. You know? And so I'm just like, what is this? This thing's like standing there on the other side of the fence. And like I've said this before multiple times, I don't really remember a smell. I don't remember the eyes glowing in particular. I just, you know, the you know, and over the years, I've had so many people give me encounters, you know, that I've tried to be careful to not let those encounters influence my memory of what I saw, you know. And from what I remember, I just remember it manipulating the fence and kind of looking up and down at the fence like I'm going to get over this fence, you know, one way or another. And then it kind of looked side to side like it was looking for a weak point, you know, and I thought, this thing is going to kill me. It's going to kill me. I felt that in my mind.
Now, were you, and of course, with the thought of, my God, this thing's going to kill me, would you say that at that point you were frozen in fear or frozen in disbelief / Both. Curiosity?
I was, curiosity was like overridden by absolute fear. Like, I mean, it was... Like,
and you're no small individual.
No,
Joshua.
I'm 6'4", and I weigh like 370. Yeah. So, yeah. And at that time, I wasn't 370 pounds, and I wasn't even 6'4 yet. But yeah, it was, and I'm built like, I have a power lifter type frame. You know, I am extremely strong. I don't like saying that because then I get attacked like, oh, Scott, that she's strong. You know, like,
yeah.
But I do lift weights like pretty regularly, and I do have a pretty massive, you know, a build. And even then I lifted weights, I played sports, and I was like looking at this thing and I, you know, there's no way, even now, as big as I am, anybody, I don't care who you are, you can be the strongest man, toughest UFC fighter on a physical level, you have no chance with these things. And I would try to, you know, tell people that, and they took it the wrong way. Like I was trying to brag on myself, and I'm like, no, dude, I'm trying to explain that you have no chance physically with these beings, you know?
Yeah, like you didn't even have a chance. You were just lucky that it didn't do anything.
Absolutely, yeah. And it wasn't, and I think it would have. People were like, "Well, you know, it didn't do anything, but it could have if it wanted to." No, it wanted to. I absolutely know it wanted to. I mean, it looked at us as like, you know, we're on the menu. But the fence slowed it down, and I think that when my friend came down, he looked over at my friend's dad. When he came out, he looked over at him and was kind of, you know, judging him. And that's when I bolted, and I got in the house, and then it turned and walked back in between the two houses. The one, like I said, was vacant, and then that's where they used to live. They were evicted, but it looked into the window, and a couple of his family members, my friend, I was sitting on the couch just stunned. And I give Sal a lot of credit because that man was brave. He went out with a gun, a 12 gauge, to confront me, you know, and like, you know, and now subsequently. Man. For years and years, I thought this is a flesh and blood thing that happened to me. And I was in that camp for years. Now I'm writing a book. And as of this podcast recording, I'm probably about 2 weeks away from finishing that book. And it is dealing with werewolves, dogmen, whatever. And when that book is complete, then it'll have a lot of stories and different encounters of multiple people. I got a lot of people from the community to give stories and donate stories to the book. I collected a lot of stories too from my hometown. And so there's like, I guess, what's the word? Smattering? Is that the right word?
Sure.
There's a smattering of different types of encounters there. I tried to, and I even picked some up from other countries. I have collected, I don't even know. I know Anthony's sitting over here next to me in the studio. How many do you think we've collected? 1,000 maybe?
At least
1,000. Yeah.
Wow.
And I do a lot of work on that. Like I go out to all these groups and I get tons of emails, tons of messages, and I track people down. But you know, you'd be surprised. Some of the best encounters are chance encounters. Like one time we were just sitting in Taylor at Randy's Ice House, which is a local beer joint there. And I wasn't there to drink beer. I was just there to pick up food because they make a darn good burger. And so me and Anthony were there picking up our food and we had already called it in, and it wasn't, but like, you know, a 10-minute wait or something. My wife was out in the truck, you know, looking at her phone, whatever. And we met these people that had an encounter right outside of Lexington. And it was very much an ethereal encounter where it was like they drove through this thing. Like it looked just like a werewolf in the road, and they're bracing for impact, and they drove right through it. And then I got them on the show on the live stream, and they talked about it. Now I've got a podcast and a live stream. And so we do dogman/ werewolf stuff quite often.
Yep.
It's a very big, broad topic now. It's not like it used to be just kind of a fringe, you know, paranormal topic. It's now become like its own whatever, its own genre. Right. And when you go and you look at the accounts, there's so many of them that just seem to like be more on the ethereal side.
Yeah.
It starts to show you like a pattern. you know, and I went from being this flesh and blood, and the nail in the coffin for me was when I talked to my friend's brother who was remodeling a house, which this is kind of creepy too, but in its own, there was a guy that had killed himself in that house. And the legend when we were growing up was that it was haunted. And we would see stuff in that house. Like, we'd be walking by at night and you see the lights go on and off. And there was no homeless people there back then. There was nobody. And we just like, oh, well, that's the haunted house. So my friend's brother was like remodeling it. And we went in there and he was showing me, and this was December 2019. And I was thinking about buying a piece of property there in Taylor close by. And that piece of property that was where the dog man was actually the guy was trying to sell that, according to my friend's brother. And I was thinking about buying it. And then I thought, how crazy would that be to actually know that that thing stood in my front yard? So I was like, because that house had been leveled. It's gone now. And so that's just a big vacant lot. And I thought, nah, man, I can't see myself building on that, you know? And even though it was a pretty reasonable price, yeah. So we're at this haunted house, basically a haunted house. Sounds kind of goofy to call it a haunted house. No, it's not like a fun house. It's scary. But we were in there and I was like, dude, do you ever hear anything? And right when I said that, like, we hear a bang, bang. And we go into the master bedroom and no lie, man, the sawhorses had fallen inward.
Oh, wow.
On a level floor. I mean, like, and we're looking at each other and our friend's brother, he's like, and I don't want to say his name. I don't have permission to use his name. I've never really gotten permission from him. He doesn't really like to talk about what happened, you know, openly out, you know, nor does his dad. Because they go to Pentecost church and their mother, she was very much like, don't talk about it. It's the El Diablo, you know, and so they absolutely kind of adopted that. But my friend that I was with, my best friend that saw it with me, he's now a preacher in my hometown, and he's talked about it a few times, but he's not been like me, you know. He hasn't gone down the rabbit hole. But since our encounter, we've both had multiple paranormal experiences, and I do plan to try to get him to come on our show and talk about it at some point, but I have a bazillion people I need to interview, including you.
Yeah.
I need to get you on the show, too.
Well, and it's interesting, though, Josh, because one of the things that we talk about regularly on this show is the cultural differences of experiences and exactly the way that it does affect families and the way that some people, not that they wouldn't like to talk about it, but for cultural shame of their family, they don't talk about it.
Exactly. I just ran into that with the Filipino family I was trying to interview about the Oswang. That happened with me with the Japanese stories too. Luckily, yep. I got a couple of really good friends that hail from Japan and then a couple that live there, and they're Japanese, and they were willing to, my one friend's from Kyoto, and they were willing to help us, you know, and so we had some help with that. And I'm getting ready to try to do one on Hong Kong. And I got a couple of friends of mine, and then I got several friends that live in Phuket. They're kickboxers, known them for years, and we're working on a Thailand episode. Wow. So we got all these projects. I do like about 10 of them at a time, 10 to 12, you know, and then I do like a little bit. That's why I started writing one book and then I'm writing two. And I'll be done with one, like I said, a couple of weeks. The other one should be about 3 or 4 weeks. And one's Bigfoot and the other one's werewolves. But it's really what changed my view completely was 2019. That was, like I said, the nail in the coffin. Mm. I had had my show since April of 2019. And I had a co-host at that time who was just getting ready to quit because he was just about fed up with the bullying that we had gone through. And there was some issues. And so it was just too much. We got bullied by some bigger shows.
It can get a little thick in the communities, man. It really can.
Mm-hmm. And I experienced, some of the backlash when I decided to do an about face and say, hey, these things could be something other than flesh and blood, because one of the largest shows out there, and I'm not going to say his name, but he tries to push that narrative as much as he can. And there was at that time, anyway, a large part of the community wanted to be recognized and be legitimate. So they were doing everybody a disservice by just making this thing into like a completely flesh and blood phenomenon. Now, here's what happened. My friend's brother, he told me, he says, you know, he goes, we were talking about this haunted house and this thing that had just happened. And my nephew was with me, and he said to my nephew, he goes, man, let's go outside and talk. So we went outside, and he goes, man, he goes, I always think when I'm out here working at night, he goes, I'm not really worried about the ghost. I always think about that thing we saw, you know? And so we started talking about that.
Sure.
And then he said, you know, it was so creepy. There was like this black vapor coming out the back of its neck as he was telling Anthony this, you know? And I was like, wait, whoa, what? I was kind of looking at my phone, you know, kind of zoning out as he was talking about it. I know I've heard about it 1,000 times. And I said, did you say a black vapor? And I'm like, I'm talking 1990. This is 29 years later.
Yeah.
And so I said, dude, wait a minute. And I was like, what was that? And he goes, yeah, there was like this vapor coming off the back of its neck. It was like black smoke or something, but it was thick. It looked weird, you know? And so I was like, black vapor, like what is that, you know, like and I said, you never told me that. And he was like, well, you never asked.
And so you seen the same thing, Josh?
Do what?
Had you seen the same thing?
No, I, you know, he said, yeah, when it walked by the window to the, you know, and they since remodeled that house, but I was like, what would this black vapor be? What is that? You know what I mean? Like, you know, and so it was so weird to me. But after that, hell, I've probably fielded 200 or 300 reports, you know, since then, that involve some sort of like really, really weird ethereal something or other. And I have heard reports of smoke and mist and have gone over with the late Linda Godfrey. We became fast friends years ago, and we shared stories and reports with each other. But it was hard to like wrap my mind around, like, look, I saw something. I always thought mine was flesh and blood, but maybe it wasn't. There was some sort of ethereal.
Sure.
And so I don't know what that was. I've thought about it so many times, but I'll tell you this. After I went down the whole spectrum of emotions, which always ends with acceptance, I talked about it. And so then I got the nickname Wolf, because they used to call me Wolf Boy. Mm. And one of my coaches was like teasing me, and, you know, football practice, and he's like, you know, why don't you hit him hard, you know, like a real wolf, not a wolf boy. And I just remember thinking, yeah, you're right. So I started being like, you know, ferocious and adopting that moniker. And then I boxed, and I did, you know, a bunch of MMA stuff, and I coached, did all kinds of things. And so that was, I adopted that persona. And then I worked downtown for years at a nightclub, and, you know, it was a pretty rough place. And so the name just stuck over the years. Everybody, all my friends, even my parents called me Wolf. I mean, like my family, everybody called me that. It's not until I started doing this show that I started getting called Josh again, and I had to start getting used to that, because people would be like, Josh, and I'm like, I rarely hear that name.
My wife was introduced to me as Waldo. When we re-met on social media, like 20 something years later, she had to be reminded what my college nickname was, because nobody knew my name was Chris. Anytime friends introduced me, it's like, yeah, this is Waldo. That was just my name. Like, the generations of people at my school know about me, but they do not know my actual name. They just know about Waldo. They've just heard these stories about this dude named Waldo. Yeah. So, you know, you could have had that one. Like, at least you had something cool like Wolf.
Well, you know, at least yours was born of, like, you know, not hateful teasing. Like, mine was born of, like, people just making straight up fun of me, you know? Like, kind of like playful, you know, your friend.
Yeah, I guess mine was actually born in the seminary, because in a house of like 55, 60 guys, you know, between all the grade levels of college and in between, they were like, man, for a 6-foot-tall redhead, you could just disappear. Like, you could not be seen for days. I don't know how you do that.
that's weird that you spent a year in seminary. I mean,
you know, it was probably one of the first places where I actively experienced what I would consider to be paranormal, Josh. Mm. My first paranormal experience is what led me to the seminary, which was what I believe to be one of many full ecstatic prayer experiences I have had in my life, where I was in full union with what I know to be God. And it was an incredible moving experience. And awesome. Thank God for Father John Upton out there. If you're still out there, my friend, because there aren't a lot of priests that when you go to them after mass as a server and you've worked with them for years, that they'd be like, oh, really? All right. Well, let's talk about that some more. You know, there's a lot of people who even in that field and wearing a collar, Josh, would call you crazy for having a paranormal experience and for even having an experience like that where you feel as though you have experienced the presence of God. That's a big taco, you know?
Yeah.
So yeah, that was my first, I guess, foray into experiencing something other than, and I have held it close and near to my heart, and it has been what I judge the other than by. Most definitely, like the few other paranormal experiences I've had, like that same feeling has been there. It's been really interesting, and really interesting to see that kind of develop over the years. Because yes, I feel as though I am more open to it. And it's interesting because a minute ago, you said that there were some people within communities that fell out with you because you came to the point of understanding that many of these sightings of werewolves, lycanthropes, dogmen, what have you, even into the Bigfoot realm, may not necessarily be the actual cryptid itself, but something else.
Yeah, and that's interesting that you worded it like the actual cryptid itself, like there is a cryptid there. I'm not saying that
there isn't. Like, no, hey, especially when it comes to Bigfoot. Like, sure, well, but could something else be hijacking our mental state and readiness and acceptance of that? Sure.
I'll get into this because I just had this conversation, actually, a mutual friend of ours, Ken Gerhard.
Yeah.
And I had to recruit him and Barton and several other people that, because I did over 60 interviews and I couldn't do them all myself. There's too many.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we were going over the interviews and I'm laying it out in my book. And Ken and me had this conversation. I had a friend of mine whose grandfather was, they were from the Ute Reservation. His grandfather had basically was an elder. And had told me that these things, there are things that can mimic these creatures and mimic Bigfoot and all these other types of things.
Sure.
But there definitely is. There is. And now the question is like, are we dealing with werewolves? Are we dealing with something that's always that way all the time? And people like that idea that it's always that way all the time because, you know, werewolves can't exist, right? Because Hollywood made that up. And so, of course, they're not real. That's what people think.
Well, I mean, ancient Greece made that up. When you start really digging into
modern eye,
lycanthropy and the
King Lycan.
Yeah. It was, you know, stories of wolfmen and things like that definitely go back to Greek and Roman days.
Mm-hmm. Even before that, actually.
Oh, absolutely.
The Sumerians had tradition of a city that was actually destroyed in the land of Ur. By a like werewolf type creatures, but we've also heard stories of vampiric type creatures doing the same thing. These legends go back a long, long ways, and then you go into Alexander the Great, you know, and then Marco Polo. There's all these mentions of these creatures going way back, ancient, you know, India and China. So the idea has been there a long time, and I think there's more than just wolves. I think there's jaguars and bears, and it gets really, really weird. But if you just keep going down that rabbit hole, but let's back up for a second.
Yes,
the encounters that I when I went into my hometown and I started doing like research and trying, there wasn't a lot out there. I didn't have the internet, so I had to read every book I could on werewolves. And my friend, I tried to get him to try to help with the research. He wasn't really interested in that. He was just like, man, it's just a devil. I don't want to think about it. I don't want to talk about it. I wanted to know what it was. And I talked to bunches of people who had been witnesses. And I say 1990 was the year of the dog man because, oddly enough, my wife, we met because of this phenomenon. And she actually
– oh, wow.
Yeah, she saw a werewolf type creature come into her house when she was a kid with her sister in the Mojave Desert. And so that story is going to be in my book. But
oh, man.
It was so weird that, you know, like that she reached out to me because I had been on another guy's show talking about my research and given the stories that I had been given. And some of the stories are really good. They're show worthy. You can get on there and tell them, you know, and it makes for good entertainment. But then some of them are very just short. But even the short ones can be pretty gnarly. I'll tell you one, just give you an example from Heiko. There was a couple, and they were driving in a pretty tall SUV, and the road out there on that county road. I don't know what county road it is because I don't have the notes for that in front of me. But I remember the story pretty well because the woman was very distraught about it, and it took her a couple weeks to actually talk to me after initially talking to her husband. She was in the passenger side, and they were driving right out of Heiko, Texas, and the road kind of went down into like a steep ditch, a few feet. Like if you were to veer off that road, you'd be stuck in a deep ditch. So, you know, this thing was pretty down in there, and these things were eating something, and it was nighttime, and they were coming back from like a I think it was like a barbecue or something, some kind of function. And one of these creatures stood up, and it was like there was just blood all over its muzzle, all the way down its chest. And they were eating what looked like a hog or a deer. She couldn't tell. She saw hooves. And the other one kind of continued to do what it was doing. And then it stood up right behind it. And when she drove by, she got a good look at him. And it was just like a really quick encounter, but it was terrifying. She saw these two bloody, what can only be described as, you know, almost 7.5-8 feet tall werewolves. And she said that they were like as tall as the SUV, and they're 3 feet down in a ditch. And she's just like not quite eye level, like with the not with the window or the top of the vehicle, but, you know, out of the ditch, she said probably 8 feet tall. Her husband even estimated that they may have been even bigger. Like there were two of them, and one was taller than the other. And he said he would say 8.5 feet, you know, and I was like, wow. And it's a very quick encounter.
Yeah.
But I told that one because of like, even though it was a short encounter and it was brief, it was just a terrifying thing to see this bloody werewolf on the side of the road eating something.
Yeah.
And they just stood up with their, you know, with their chest, you know, just, you know, like with like bowed out. And, you know, the guy driving, he kind of described them to me as like being, he didn't say majestic, but he used the word stoic. And it kind of, and he implied that they were like this, like they were warriors, you know, like savage warriors. You know, he just looked like they were just ready to fight. Like, you know, like, what are you looking at? And then just keep driving.
Unfazed by his presence.
Exactly. And they didn't give chase or anything like that. They were busy doing what they were doing. And his wife was hysterical. And then she had nightmares. She couldn't sleep, had all kinds of problems. You know, when you deal with these encounters, like, you know, it's a very brief encounter, but it's very, has a lasting effect on everybody.
Yeah.
And, you know, interviewing some of the people around my hometown, I'll give you another one that I haven't ever told on any shows yet at all.
Ooh.
I got a guy reached out to me. He lives in Colorado, and he actually lives, I think now he lives like in Pueblo or outside of Pueblo. But he told me that, oh, I'm sorry, you know what? He lives in Colorado Springs. Not that it matters, but anyway, Colorado Springs. Sorry. And so he had family in Taylor that had migrated from Mexico. And this was in 2005. And so he went down there to visit. You know, he had cousins, like I said, in Mexico that came, and they stayed with some other family members, and then they got their own place. And so they wanted to see him. He used to go down there and visit them annually, but they were now living in Taylor. He had no real connection to Taylor other than the family that moved there. And so he ended up going down there and staying in 2004 for the summer, which when he was like 16, and then he did it again the next year. So he had a blast hanging out, you know, whatever, and running around doing all the stuff out in the country and stuff in Southside Taylor. So he went back in 2005. He wanted to go back and stay for a month or whatever. And there's a little corner store right there on Main Street that's right there at the foot of a bridge. Like there's this big bridge that goes over the railroad tracks. And it used to be, Taylor used to be very segregated. That was the part of South Taylor was black and the other side was Hispanic.
The division ditch.
Yeah, basically. Yes. Yeah. And then the other side was a mix. There was a Mexican neighborhood like where I was at on the other side in Central Taylor. And then there was like different white communities. There were predominantly Czech and German and just a few Anglo families. Mm. And that was kind of the breakup, the breakdown, whatever. But they lived in the south side of Taylor, and they would walk to the store all the time. And one night when they were walking to the store, they didn't go down. There was this little corner store, like I said, by an old cotton gin, which I don't know if that was still going at that time, but it was defunct. I didn't ask that, but there was a warehouse there that wasn't in operation. And now, I think now it might be, or it became operational after that. Like I said, this is years ago. But they would walk the long way. They would go up against this road, and I'll have probably in my book, I'll have the name of the road, whatever, and I'll show the whatever. But there was just a bunch of overgrowth right there separating the road and from the side of the road from the railroad tracks. There's just like all this growth, you know, which is still there to this day. There's nothing there. It never has been. And like I said, on the other side, like there's this warehouse, and then you walk, and then there's like a cotton gin, and then you get to the end of the street, and you take a right, and you go across this little field, and then you're at the corner store. Well, the reason they went the long way is because there was a couple of dogs that were running around loose and on the street that they lived on. So if they just walked straight to the store, the dogs would you know, harass them and chase them. So they would always walk the long ways. Well, one night when they were walking the long way, his cousin Chewy said he heard something, and he was like, "I hear something in the brush." And then they all were talking, laughing, and then they stopped as a group of teenagers, you know, and they're like, "Ah, there's nothing there, dude. Whatever. You're just imagining things." So they just kept going. They get to the store. They're walking back the other, you know, down that same road the other way. And at this point, his female cousin, one of the female cousins, turns and looks, says, "No, I saw something." Like, and she's like, "Be quiet. There's something there." And then they heard like this crashing through the brush again, and then they take off running. And then they kind of joked about it. They were like, "Oh, it's probably just a raccoon." So the kind of a nightly ritual, they would walk back to, you know, to the store. So 8, 9 o'clock at night, they're going back up to the store, you know, because all they did was play video games and hang out and do whatever, you know. And then, you know, every now and then they'd go out to swim and do stuff like that, you know. But it was just, you know, he enjoyed being around kids his own age and just, sure, you know, having fun, whatever. But after this incident, that was pretty much it. He had his fill of Taylor. And I'll tell you why. They were going to the store on this particular night after this, the first, you know, night that they had the weird thing happen. And as they're getting to that point in where the brush, you know, is real thick on the left side, there's like a warehouse on the right. I'll have pictures and stuff of this in my book too. But like with the spot where it happened, they see this big wolf looking head stick out of the brush.
Oh, no.
And then they see like these massive shoulders followed by arms. And it was like tearing through the vines and the brush, and it was coming out at them. And they all took off running, unfortunately, in different directions. Some ran down the street toward the store, and then some ran across the field toward the gin. And then the other two, him and his cousin, his like favorite cousin, who was his best friend, Chewy, they took off straight going back down toward the house. And sure enough, they round the corner, and there's those two dogs start chasing him. And he's like, "Dude, I was never so happy to see dogs, you know, to chase me in my life." After seeing that thing, he was like, "This is a blessing that I'm able to be chased by dogs." Because he goes, "This demonic werewolf," like he kept calling it that when we talked. He said, "This demon," you know. And I asked him. I said, "Do you think it was just flesh and blood, or was it really a demon?" And he said, "I think it was a demonic entity." And he said that the eyes were glowing like an orangey yellow, and he said that it was large, probably, you know, 7.5-8 feet tall. You know, and when I went back and I snapped a couple photos and I sent them to him, and I said, you know, "From the brush right here that I'm showing you, you know, give me kind of a point, you know, to where, how tall this thing," you know. And so he showed me, I measured it. It was probably 8 foot, you know. So this thing was very massive. The shoulders were like 3.5-4 foot wide.
Oh, man.
And so he said that it was a giant looking creature and that who knows how long it had been watching them and been planning to try to ambush them. When his other cousins got, they all kind of met up at the store, the four other cousins that were like with him, or three other cousins. They called, and of course the aunt, you know, was already on her way down the store to pick them up. And then that was it. No more walking around at night. You know, it was, yeah. So there was a whole, you know, like a flap going on. I told him about it. I said in 1990, and I put this in my book, there was like, you know, several people who had seen these creatures that year.
Interesting.
And I told him about that. And he says, well, he says, I got another one for you from my cousin's girlfriend that lived outside of Copeland at that time. And that was in 2005. Mm. And it was sort of the same thing. It was like this. They were walking from the creek. There was a creek out there and they were looking for like crawdads. I guess that's what you know, crawfish, whatever.
Sure.
Or we called them mud bugs, you know. They look like, you know, like crawfish, whatever.
Freshwater lobsters.
Yeah, freshwater lobsters. They were out there looking for them, and this creek would fill up pretty regularly. And they were out there one day, and they saw this thing kind of sliding around in the mud and then kind of popping up. And they had their little one of them's little brother with them, and he was like, big doggy. And he pointed, and when they see this big head – this thing that's caked in mud, like stands up in the creek bed and just stands there staring at him. And they said it was about 7 foot tall. It wasn't quite as big as this other one. It didn't have nearly as big as shoulders, and it had a real pointy snout with real tall ears, which they described this other thing looking very wolf-like. And that's important to know that, because you get a lot of stories that sound more like bear looking creatures or something, you know, which is something I've been getting reports of as of late. But this thing looked like a werewolf, just quintessential werewolf, had the backward bent legs. Now, you know, the guy that gave me this story, Alex and Chewy, they didn't provide any like description of the legs, because they didn't see them. But they saw the upper body, and so I couldn't tell you whether they were the backward bent legs like what I saw. And this thing that I saw had this weird looking claw. Like the way I could describe it is like if you see like a raptor, like in, you know, like in Jurassic Park, where they have the kind of this big claw. It looks like they have like three toes kind of sticking out with this like one, and then one that's like really big, like a claw. And I thought, what is that for? Unless it's to use its feet to grab. It's not like a wolf. It's not like a man. And the hands have these big, nasty looking claws too. And the mouth and face are oversized. I mean, there's just like this humongous mouth that looks almost unnatural. Like the snout is too big, but it's elongated. And pretty much on par with what I saw, like he was describing to me, and I was like, oh yeah. And so going back to this other encounter that happened in between Copeland and Rice's Crossing, a little bitty spots on the road there, a little bit of nothing, but they were in this creek bed, and she freaked out, which would have been Chewy's girlfriend. She was like 14, and she was the oldest. She had two little brothers and with her, you know, and just like there was nowhere to go. They're down in this creek bed. They just turn around and take off running, and they see their uncle who's riding on an ATV. And like they start waving, and he heads in their direction. And as he does, the noise from the ATV seems to have made this thing jump out of the ditch and take off, and, you know, in the opposite direction, not running, just kind of walking, nonchalantly walking. When this guy in the ATV got up to them, he did not see this thing, which is weird because they were like pointing right at it, and it was like he couldn't see it. Which I thought was interesting too, because reports of people, there's like six people in a group. This happened on the Guadalupe River. And the only people that saw it were four Hispanic people, a white person and a black person. And the only people that saw it were three of the Hispanic people. Now, interesting enough, four Hispanic people, but only three of them were Mexican. One of them was not. Okay. So the Mexican people, which were all part of the same family, you know, it's Hernandez family, which I've talked about before. They saw it and it was legit. It looked like a, you know, it looked legit like a werewolf. one of the other people saw something that looked like a blurry, pixelated thing. They couldn't tell what it was. And then the other two didn't see. It was just like they didn't see it. It was just so weird. Like, why did those people from that particular family who had problems with these things before, why did they see it and the other people not see it? Who knows? You know, it's such a weird phenomena. And when you start going down the rabbit hole with these things and these encounters, and Bigfoot gets like that too.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
It gets really weird. Well, and then you start getting into like alien abduction and ghosts and people who are experiencers. And next thing you know, Bigfoot shows up or Dogman shows up. And
one of the things that we have discussed regularly on this show, Josh, whether it's now Dogman, Bigfoot, paranormal experiences with ghosts, demons, what have you. Even UFO, not only abduction, but witnessing. Is that phenomena of a mixed group of people, some people seeing it and some people not? One of the shows that I did last year was with Kathleen Martin. She is actually one of the founders and heads of the UFO experiencer team with MUFON. She is the niece of Betty and Barney Hill and done some amazing work. And it was interesting because she had just come out with a new book and was saying that much of her research had started going much, much more down a spiritual path. And these experiencers who had much more of a mystical experience and told the story of one gentleman who actively went to touch a craft and passed through it and then was able to come back through the craft. Now, about a month or two later, I actively went to the remote viewing conference and had a chance to talk with Hal Putoff at breakfast, all kinds of things, and saw him speak. And one of the cases that he brought up was the exact same case and the phenomenology of a mixed group of people being able to see something and some in the group not. He's like, much like the gentleman who passed through the skin of the aircraft, that he was witnessing, that seems to be a vibrational phenomenon. Like, he is vibrating at the same frequency as that craft, which would explain why he could see it and other people couldn't, you know, things like that. So it's interesting to see that really strange phenomenology, even stretching to Dogman, because that is a known odd thing that happens with many phenomenological events where some people that are present just can't see what's happening.
Yeah. And it's like different people see different things, and it's so, I don't know how to describe it. It is vibration. We are all just vibrations, just kind of in harmony. And that's what it is. I mean, I've gone down the rabbit hole on that too. I mean, it's the vibrational thing. Like, it's, you know, one of the things that you know, I know, I lived in a house that was haunted, and it didn't happen, you know, right after my encounter or anything like that. It was years later. In fact, I think it was like 6 years later when I ended up living in a haunted house. But a couple years before that, I'd say about, let's see, 2 or 3 years after I had the encounters, the encounter with the Dogman creature, I worked in a building that was haunted. Then another 2 or 3 years went by, and I ended up living in a place that was haunted. And saying it's haunted just sounds silly. It was beyond that. And, you know, and I know that these things can physically touch you. They can physically hurt you.
Yeah.
And they do it in a way that is just like, it's so insidious, and you can't, it's like you can't fight it. The only way for me, and I'm a Christian, I just, you know, Christ is the only thing that's ever been able to work for me in getting these things to chill out, calm down, whatever, leave you alone. And I know a lot of people that are just atheists and they don't like to hear that. But there's no arguing with the fact that it does work. If you have faith, it does work. And that's the only thing that's ever been able to work for me. And I do pray. And I tell people all the time, I was like, you have no chance with these things. The only thing you can do is pray.
They're playing by a different set of rules.
Absolutely. And they understand the laws of physics much better than we do.
Yeah.
And we're kind of hamstrung by our own, like, inability to see that we're not as smart as we think we are.
The box in which we live, so to speak.
Yes. And people ask me all the time, like, what I think they are. I've gone on and on and on my show, postulating on theories and theology on what these things could be. Dude, I couldn't tell you. I'm no closer, but I can tell you I have a lot of ideas. I've explored inner Earth quite a bit and looking, not physically gone there and explored it, but looking at that as a possibility. But you get weird stories too. Like, I had this one story, this lady, and this is real brief, but, you know, she had an encounter with, like, what I can only describe as, like, these mantis-type creatures during an abduction. And she saw two of these, what just looked like werewolves, like, standing on either side of this door, which I guess was a door. It was made like a door, but it was smooth. There was no handle or anything. Mm. And she asked me what I thought that was. And I was like, your guess is as good as mine. I mean, yeah. What were they doing there during an abduction? I also got one out of Scotland where these people had gone out and they saw this, what looked like a craft, and they went toward it. And they see this dog man looking creature laying there on the ground, kind of twitching. And they asked me, the guy's like, what do you think that was? And I'm like, I don't know, but it was. Yeah. But I know I would get the heck out of there. I'm not going to sit there and... Why don't we ask it, you know?
Well, you know. And, you know, it's interesting because at that point you do have the question of two different phenomena happening at the same time. And the question mm-hmm. that we've brought up regularly is, at that point, do you start investigating the dog man or the craft first?
And are you they know? Different, though? Are they separate? We don't know.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, if you go by the Anunnaki theory that, you know, we came from – whatever, you know, and just, I'm not going to get into a big dissertation about that, but you can look that up, folks, about the Anunnaki. I've postulated on the theory that possibly they use these as sentinels to guard and protect their stargates. And we get a ton of reports of these things in graveyards, which is just like totally, it'll be in my book too, yeah. A bunch of different stuff about that, you know. You know, yeah. It's just, you go down and just keeps going and going.
Well, and it does keep going and going. Not only that, it crosses over. Say it's a literal honeycomb, man. Mm-hmm. The way that so many of these communities have begun crossing over the last few years,
which is correct, because decompartmentalization needs to happen. Tearing down the walls.
Yeah, yeah. We definitely, I think that especially here in the last couple of years with everything going on disclosure wise, there have been a lot of conversations open. Add to that the swath, literal swath of media that is out there now, whether it's books from fantastic publishers like Into the Fray, things like that.
Oh, yeah.
That have really brought some of these things like Dog Man and stuff like that to a point of popular culture, you know. The mini Monster Quest-esque shows that have popped up over the last decade. Even paranormal shows. They are like, hey, I watch Skinwalker Ranch every week. My wife loves that show. But You have to admit that there is some editing to what's happening. Yeah. And it's funny because I jump to the defense all the time of Curse of Oak Island, because after 10 seasons, people are like, oh, they ain't going to find nothing. It's like, I guess you missed all of the history mm-hmm. that they found, like all the actual science. None of that is treasure.
Yeah, they don't look at anything, and another problem too, people don't read like they used to either. Sure. I mean, if they want to learn about something, they don't go and find like a really in-depth book. You know, like somebody was asking me the other day about a good book on the Djinn, and I told them, you know, Legends of the Fire Spirits, and this ask hole. I call these people ask holes because they ask you a question, you answer it, and then they don't, you know.
Yeah.
It's, the guy messaged me again asking me a bunch of questions about, you know, because he's like, well, you've studied the Quran, you know, and all this stuff. And I'm not Islamic, but I've read it, and I've read the sure. Vedas, Hindus, and all this other stuff, and about Buddhism and various different sects of Christianity. Mm. And of course, there's a bunch of different sects of all these different religions. And so he asked me about it, and I said, dude, did you read the book I recommended? He said, yeah, I got it, but I just haven't had time. And I'm, it's like 9 months later, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm like, dude, how long does it take to read a book? I'm not bashing on the guy for, he's a listener. He admittedly was like, kind of, yeah, he goes, I should have read it. You know, I'm sorry. I said, well, find the time. I mean,
yeah, yeah. And,
I'm a very busy guy. I run a large business, and I do this, you know, and I, like I said, I used to do all kinds of other stuff, and I had to kill everything else and just focus on these two things. And yep. It's all encompassing, and I still find time to read my friends' books that come out. You know, we have a lot of the same friends.
I had two documentaries on today in the background while I was doing stuff, like literally
multitasking, that, downloading knowledge.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, I treat it like talk radio, man. I just have it on in the background while I'm coding website or whatever, you know? Yeah. And yes, just it used to be my fun thing that while I would be doing that, I would literally go onto LinkedIn and like, oh, I like what that dude's saying. And like, go stalk him down on LinkedIn. Like Steve Bassett, that's how we became First Degree Connected many years ago. Was like, oh, I really like his point of view on that. That's like, that's awesome. I've heard of Paradigm Research Group, but, man, I really like how transparent that guy is about it. And just went and followed him. And it's interesting that you can do that nowadays. And I think that, that is also part of the problem, Joshua. Like I remember going and I don't know how many times I checked out the books on werewolves, vampires, amulets and talismans, things like that from my local library, because that's what was there. You know, yeah. That's what was available to me on that side of Houston and where I could go in the world at the age that I was. but all of that is at our fingertips now.
Yeah, and people still don't want to. Well, want to, you know. Don't and to, there's researchers.
It comes down to the time of the filtering of the knowledge. It's not mm-hmm. that you don't have access and that you can't. Hey, peruse a quarter of an article. All right. The problem is the vetting of that information, and the actual how fast the sieve gets clogged. You know, because like. A filter does a great job until you start putting more material into it than what it's supposed to process,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that's kind of what our brain is like. It has the capacity to take in a vast amount of information, but it's not until it has that information in there that it can actively filter it and compare it, you know. So it's an odd little system that kind of traps us, especially those of us that through experience, Josh, are true believers. Like I am a true believer, but at the same token, I've been an audio video editor and cameraman for like 20 something years of my life. Like I spot anomalies real quick.
Yeah.
You know, like that it's just what part of what I do, you know? And it's one of those that scientifically, if there were that many out there, it would no longer be an anomaly.
Yeah.
At that point, it's a known quantitative. Like there's a couple people in some groups that I belong to that post videos from their backyard 3-4 times a week. And it's like, man, at that point, you could be selling tickets, dude. Like, like if you had that kind of dependability of phenomenon, you could be selling tickets to that. You wouldn't be here on social media. We would be seeing an ad on social media for your tour.
Yeah, you'd be you know? Up there. it's and, like, you know, and I've had a lot of weird phenomena happen to me, but it's not all been the same.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. And like I haven't experienced, I'm not an abductee, but I have done a lot of research on that just because it seems like it comes up over and over again. Just like people who see Dog Man, it's like a lot of them have lived in haunted houses or they've played with Ouija boards. And that's another thing. They play with Ouija board and then boom, something happens, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And it's interesting because once again, and kind of loops us right back to that part of the conversation of, is it the actual phenomenon or is it something else that is basically using our belief as a form of consent?
Mm-hmm. Tulpas are very real. And we've looked at that tulpa as another, dude, that's a whole nother weird. David Wedley was on my live stream, we talked about tulpas. And he gave the story of a monk, you know, that was created by a woman's belief when she was studying in Tibet.
Yeah.
Which at that time was called the Forbidden Kingdom, you know, and it was like Westerners didn't go there.
An egregore is what it's called in magic, where it's basically almost the equivalent of a golem that is created through the mental energy of a group of people. Yeah. I mean, even Wes Craven, that's one of my favorite writing stories ever, was after he wrote and released the first Nightmare on Elm Street. He believed that he actively helped create something that possessed the Night Stalker and took over the Night Stalker. That basically this mass hysteria over his character created this mentality that took over this guy. Pretty wild concept and goes straight to the root of Freddy Krueger, you know, and the whole idea of the mass fear of all of these people had manifested something back from the other side and was a channel for that. And, you know, we really have to consider that even when you're talking remote viewing, that kind of stuff. All of that came from a paper that Hal Puthoff wrote years ago about how scientists were inadvertently affecting their experiments when they went home and were thinking about their experiments.
Wow.
That and now, like this last year, Entangled Particles at a Distance won the quantum physics prize, you know, won the Nobel Prize in Physics. Proving the fact that, yes, particles on one side can utterly affect particles on the other side. That non-local reality concept. So it's interesting to see quantum mechanics, quantum physics really kind of tying the paranormal to reality.
Well, that's what it is. I mean, you know, people talk about brujería negra, which is like black magic. And I tell them it's really black science. Mm. It's just science that hasn't caught, you know, people think it's magic, but it hasn't caught up yet, you know.
Well, you know, even the idea of manifestation. You hear Joel Osteen talk about that law of attraction concept all the time. And yeah, like if you start going through and reading Kabbalah, that is a lot of the Kabbalistic teaching. Like I've told people educatedly for years, you want a reason why the Sanhedrin wanted Jesus gone. He was teaching direct communication with the divine sans the temple, you know?
Yeah. And
sans the intermediary. And that was the knowledge of the high priests.
They didn't want to share.
Yeah, and yeah. They didn't want to share the knowledge of the priests of Melchizedek with the common people. Don't be doing that. So yeah, there was a really good reason, and it's interesting to see once again all of these things kind of tying together in our modern world.
When I've talked about the Kabbalah on the show, I've had people go, "Oh, that's a Kabbalistic magic, whatever." I'm not practicing it. I just read about it. You know, I thought it was interesting their take on what demons were, because I get all these people telling me about demons, but it said that they were basically from another universe, which it doesn't always translate correctly from Hebrew to English.
The way that we
properly translate it is they were like from a fragmented universe that was, and they were compressed. They were beings that were, and then their spirits are now with us roaming around. But if you look at the Denisovian people, mm-hmm. you know, and we know that they existed, and we found molars and knuckle bones and stuff, yep. and we know that they were giants, and most of their fragments, you know, they found them in the oceans and all over the place. They were giants, and they were literally compressed by a flood. Sounds kind of like Gilgamesh, Noah, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
And if they were from a previous world, you know, the age before us, it may have been translated as like they were from another world, universe, whatever, and that they were compressed. Or it could be that they literally, their world, there was what was compressed or destroyed. And what if those beings that were compressed and destroyed, that's why they, some of them look like the mixture of animals and mm-hmm. people. Or those could have been the scientific projects of the Anunnaki. You know, I mean, who knows? Like this, the legend of Tiamat, where she actually, the goddess from the Sumerian culture,
yeah.
Mesopotamian, where she was at war with Marduk, her son, for murdering her husband. And she had her scientists go in. Well, I say scientists, but she had her sorcerers, whatever, conjure up these beings, but really it's just a science experiment. And yeah. some of them were merfolk and all these chimeras, yeah, with the scorpion man. And then they had the hairy man, which is sounds a lot like Bigfoot. And these yep. things were created and made into an army to go after, you know, Marduk. And of course, it's, you know, you go down these different roads, these different avenues, and you're like, what is this, you know? But the when you read about these different things and these different books, and then they all have kind of a common theme, and you're going like, dude, there's no denying there's a connection there, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, precisely. And the connections are far reaching and very, very universal once you start getting across culture lines. Mm-hmm. It's pretty phenomenal to see the similarities between many of these traditions. I mean, even going back to what you were saying about the Hombre Lobo and mm-hmm. and the tradition of werewolves, things like that from, once again, ancient Greece, Rome, all that kind of stuff. The idea of it being a cursed, outcast, shunned individual who becomes this shapeshifter who kind of wreaks vengeance on the countryside. Mm-hmm. It's wild to see that and to see that similarity. Now, I know you've got to get going here in a bit for a live broadcast.
Yeah, absolutely. I got to get started on that.
Before we let you go, we actually have the second annual Dogman Conference coming up. I was so happy to hear that there was a festival dedicated to this last year. I was sad that I didn't get to go, but I'm happy to be there helping with AV, things like that, for the Dogman Conference this year. Tell everybody a little bit about that and what brought that to be.
Sure. Last year was very successful. We had over 400. I think we had 438 people, and then all together, which is weird. I think that's how many tickets. And then all together, we had like 483. So invert the 3 and the 8. That's kind of weird, but and we counted that many that were just from all the people that were there and helping awesome. And doing and whatever. And we sold a bunch of tickets, and so. At any point in time in that building, there was between 400 and 500 people. And so it was very successful, and we decided to do it again. I actually lost money on the event, but you know, hey, it got it out there. And so this year we're doing it, and we have a ton of speakers. You go to Eventbrite website, and I see you're showing it right there. Second, it's Paranormal Roundtable's second annual Dogman Cryptid Conference. And there's a couple names missing from that particular spot right there. Martin Groves has agreed to come on and speak, and Tex from Texas Front Porch.
Since the beginning. Yeah.
The guys from Expanded Perspectives will be there. You'll be there. There's a lot of people that are going to be there. it'll be a who's who of the cryptid community, really. And so we're hoping people will come and check it out and get your tickets while you can, because eventually we're going to stop the sales and just, you know, put it down to a certain point and that's it. So check it out, guys.
Absolutely. It is fantastic to see events like that happening. That is a big reason why I throw myself behind the events. Being someone who does events for a living, it's one of those, if they are not properly supported by communities, things like that, it's really sad how fast events can go away.
Yeah.
And this was such a rousing success the first year, and I am looking forward to a fantastic success this year.
I hope so. So, well, if anybody needs like any information or whatever, my website, I mean, my email address is joshturner@prtpodcast.com. If you have stories you want to send me, if you want to tell me about the dog man that you've seen or whatever, I take stories of all kinds. And so, yeah. And so I'm looking forward to having you on the show too real soon, Christopher.
Absolutely, man. Yeah.
In the live.
Well, let everybody know where they can go to follow you. I know you are on all kinds of platforms. I follow you not only on social media, on the Facebook, but on YouTube as well. Let everybody know where they can go to find all your content, Josh.
I like it when people watch me on Spotify and YouTube.
All right.
But we're on a lot of different platforms. If you're not on those, that's fine too. But Spotify is one of our bread and butter, and then YouTube, of course. So go check it out. And we do a live stream every Friday and Sunday, and we do podcasts on Tuesdays and Thursdays. So you get us usually. There's a couple week break where we're going to take in between the Thursdays, and then we do like Thursdays. So Tuesdays and Thursdays, we have so much material we've been recording, and it's just, we had to do more shows because the material was just backing up.
That's awesome though. To have too much content is a great problem to have in this content hungry.
Better than the opposite. Yeah,
that's right. That's right.
When I first got into this business, I had a podcaster who I no longer really talk to him because he doesn't do this anymore, but he was lamenting that he couldn't get stories. And I'm like, dude, and I wasn't trying to be mean, but I was like, there's as many stories as there are people.
Yeah.
You know, you just got to hustle. You got to put more time and energy into it. And if you don't, then, you know, then you're not, people aren't going to come to you. Yeah. But if you make a good product, which I hope that we do, I think we do.
I think you do.
You'll get people. I appreciate that. But you'll get people that'll come to you and give you their stories, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, precisely. Yeah. I had a gentleman, who came on the show a couple times, many, many years ago in our previous incarnation, who was a psychic and a medium, who gave me the advice of keep with it, Chris. He was like, people will eventually start coming to you to share their stories.
Mm-hmm. Because that's what they did.
Because you are a trusted individual, and because of the open mind with which you approach everything. I mean, that's literally how Anonymous ended up reaching out to us years ago, to come on after the whole George Floyd incident, after they had hacked the Minneapolis Police Department, because we covered everything, and we covered it fairly evenly, you know. Yeah. So for me, it's about demystifying topics, talking about topics, even like tonight, talking about the possible paranormal connections with dogman sightings and how it may something other than, not that there isn't a physical dogman out there, but there may be something else masquerading as that. So thank you so much for your time tonight, Josh. I look forward to it. I look forward to coming on Paranormal Roundtable, talking about things. Please do hold the line while we close things out with the audience, everything else. While you are online, everybody, checking everything out from Josh Turner and Paranormal Roundtable, make sure to stop on by the Curious Realm, curiousrealm.com/videos is where you can find all of the video channels from our guests, people like King Gerhardt, Ella LeBane, Simon Hain, Hope Paranormal. We'll of course add all of the stuff from the Paranormal Roundtable channel Thank you so much, everybody, for tuning in. As always, take care of yourselves, take care of each other, and remember, stay curious. We will talk to you soon, everybody. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of The Curious Realm. Stay tuned for more guests, forbidden topics, and hidden truths. Download the official Curious Realm app and view the Knowledge Vault on our website, CuriousRealm.com. Follow us on social media by searching Curious Realm. Curious Realm is available on your favorite podcast services, as well as YouTube, Roku, Amazon Fire, and Apple TV through the APR TV app, available on all app markets. Curious Realm is a proud member of the HC Universal Network family of podcasts. For more great content or to become a sponsor of Curious Realm or other podcasts, visit hcuniversalnetwork.com today. Thanks for listening. Stay curious. And remember, the other side is always watching.